Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains.
The spice extends life.
This is where the past meets the future.
The spice expands consciousness.
In here, the results are always positive.
The spice is vital to space travel.
We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will safely be traveling with us. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. Tonight, in about 30 minutes, we have Neil Kramer coming on with us. We're going to be discussing the recent events in Boston from a different perspective I'm sure you have not heard before. We're going to apply Occam's razor to the evidence that we know, and we'll just see how it shakes out. Right now, the solar wind is a calm 276.2 kilometers per second, and the proton count is steady at 2.6 per cubic centimeter. There are five sunspot clusters, with giant sunspot 1726 having a beta gamma magnetic field that harbors energy for M-class flares. The NOAA forecasters put the odds of an M-class flare eruption at barely 10%, but that is probably an underestimate. AR-1726 poses a growing threat for a significant Earth-directed flare, and Earth is passing through a stream of debris from ancient comet Thacher, source of the annual Lyrid meteor shower. Actually, the shower is normally mild, about 10 to 20 meteors per hour, but unmapped filaments of dust in the comet's tail sometimes trigger outbursts 10 times stronger. It's 100 to 200 meteors per hour. Forecasters say the best time to look is during the dark hours before local dawn on Monday, a few hours after the program is over. All right, tonight I want to do a little bit of a setup. I'm going to let you know the phone lines are going to be open in the second hour. In the second hour, we'll open the phone lines. Right now, I just want you to listen. There was a film that was put out in 1940 called The Greatest Dictator, in which Charlie Chaplin dresses in mockery, of course, as Hitler, and brilliantly recites his lines a year before America officially enters World War II. In Europe. The words sound good and could have come from any modern candidate's speech. People listen to words, and for some people, words mean something. For most people, however, words are a tinkling sound. They look for their little piece. They sift through the sounds for a language that they can understand. And I'm going to play the speech for you now, let Charlie Chaplin be self-explanatory, and then I want you to listen very closely as I describe what this actually means and where this has gotten us to this date. Here we go. Charlie Chaplin, 1940.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone if possible. Jew, Gentile, black man, white. We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise one another. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful, but we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate, has goose-stepped us into misery and bloodshed. We have developed speed, but we have shut ourselves in. Machinery that gives abundance has left us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical, our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we We need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness. Without these qualities, life will be violent, and all will be lost. The aeroplane and the radio have brought us closer together. The very nature of these inventions cries out for the goodness in men, cries out for universal brotherhood, for the unity of us all. Even now, my voice is reaching millions throughout the world. Millions of despairing men, women, and children, victims of a system that makes men torture and imprison innocent people. To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people. And so long as men die, liberty will never perish. Soldiers, don't give yourselves to brutes. Men who despise you, enslave you, who regiment your lives, tell you what to do, what to think, and what to feel, who drill you, diet you, treat you like cattle, use you as cannon fodder. Don't give yourselves to these unnatural men with machine minds and machine hearts. You are not machines. You are not cattle. You are men. You have the love of humanity in your hearts. You don't hate. Only the unloved hate, the unloved and the unnatural. Soldiers, don't fight for slavery, fight for liberty. In the 17th chapter of St. Luke it is written, the kingdom of God is within man, not one man nor a group of men, but in all men, in you. You, the people, have the power to create machines, the power to create happiness. You, the people, have the power to make this life free and beautiful, to make this life a wonderful adventure. Then in the name of democracy, let us use that power. Let us all unite. Let us fight for a new world, a decent world, that will give men a chance to work, that will give youth a future and old age a security. By the promise of these things, brutes have risen to power, but they lie. They do not fulfill that promise. They never will. Dictators free themselves, but they enslave the people. Now let us fight to fulfill that promise. Let us fight to free the world, to do away with national barriers, to do away with greed, with hate and intolerance. Let us fight for a world of reason, a world where science and progress will lead to all men's happiness. Soldiers, in the name of democracy, let us all unite!
Okay, so you heard Charlie Chaplin's speech. It is poignant, to say the least. Then the pundits dissect the speech and re-speak the speech in words designed for their disciples. And then the religion of fear can be propagated. It can be repeated and moralized and recited again so that the followers will vomit every time they are asked why they are doing what they are doing, or voting as they are voting, or killing as they are killing. I ask you to key in on just 3 points in this speech. Just 3. Can you suffer me for just a few minutes? The first point is that of fighting. How many times have you heard a candidate say to you that he is going to Washington to fight for you? Well, fighting is the root of the problem. Fighting begets fighting. Battles and lines and soldiers and collateral damage, while the planner sits in a brothel and reaps wealth from your blood. I would not follow any man or woman who wants to fight for me. We are not swayed by the fever or adrenaline-filled oratory of skilled masters with the language who have writers smithing every syllable and metaphor for days in advance so that every effect of the play can be ascertained and predicted. I want you to disconnect when someone tells you they are ready to fight. Relax and see through the man riding across the front lines before the battle, giving the last speech you will ever hear before your body uses up the bullets of the enemy the speaker is about to send you against. See him for what he is. Know that your sovereignty is above the angels of God, and you will leave him riding in an open field alone. The second point is that subtle mention of fighting for a world without national barriers. This is cleverly put at the peak of the energy of the speech. It is easy to say and not possible to do through fighting or through force. It is the goal of every ideology. It is the purpose of every religion. And they have all tried. And they have all used the same method. They have mounted their horses and taken their swords, and they have cleaved their way into nation after nation in every age to break the souls of men to the will of the God. They have used this very speech, or ones very close to it, to whip their armies into blind whirlwinds of death and mayhem against countless villages in century after century, including this one. The third point is that of machine minds led by machine men. This is the primary point of doctrine. I was listening to an old Larry King show where four religious leaders were discussing Christianity at a time, I think it was just before Christmas. They were famous, to be sure. Their names are not significant to my point, so I'll just go on. Each tradition, and I hope you forgive me for calling their faiths a tradition, had its own line in the sand. For one, it was the words of the King James Bible. For the other, it was the Quran. For the other, it was the apocryphal writings and third century authority of its church. For another, it was the awareness and consciousness of the individual. No one was going to be converted at this table. They were all stalwarts in their traditions. This was an exchange that was moderated by Larry King, who I thought did an excellent job listening and setting the guidelines to keep one man or the other from, you know, preaching. In each man was a machine that was gathering the inputs and calculating outputs according to his machine program. They all spoke about Jesus and what their organization does with non-believers and sinners. They laid the fear of burning in hell and punishment by a God from whom you could not escape no matter where you flew in space or time. There was no secret you could keep. There was no lesson you could learn. There was no changing yourself even from your thoughts. God would find you and destroy you. Most of the machines had exactly the same formula. Do what we tell you to do and pay what we tell you to pay, or you will be hunted to the ends of the earth and plunged into a lake of fire forever. You've heard it stated, and I'm sure you've read and the alleged words of one prophet or another that we must work out our salvation with fear and trembling before the Lord. I did too. But really, did you ever read anywhere Jesus saying this to anyone? Be afraid of me. Be afraid of God. God hates you and despises you and will cast you into a pit of fire forever if you do not surrender your will to his. Let me make a proposal of thought to you. You have a will, or you would not be here on this earth. Your will and your desire is what makes you the envy of the angels. Your freedom to choose is the gift from God. No one, not God or a whole host of gods, can take that from you. In fact, if God altered the consequences of your choices, he would cease to be God, and the entire universe would collapse. Use your will to make a choice and work toward your dreams. Pretty simple, isn't it? Let's pick a candidate who will go to Washington and work for us, represent us, and watch out for us. No more fighting. Let's not fear God, but love God. Let's not judge one another, but realize that our own choices and will are a real-time judgment of ourselves. When we are angry, we are judging ourselves instantaneously with that judgment. When we are forgiving and merciful, then we are also judged with that judgment because it is an automatic function of our own will. There is no hiding from it because it is a record of our own that we make every moment of every day. Moments. Ah, yes. The only true measure of mortality. It is not time or the distance light can travel in a second. It is a capsule of consideration upon which we focus our consciousness. It can be a second, like the note of music that touches our heart, or it can be 5 minutes, like the floating through peace with a love with whom we are dancing. Or it can be a decade, if we are with a perfect person in the perfect garden. During these moments, there is no nation. There is no fighting. There is no machine. There is only love. It is not fighting, but love that will dissolve the patriotism that raises flags and aims a weapon. It is love that will open the fist and place a hand of friendship to lift another out of the dust or his poverty to be able to provide for himself. It is love that will teach a person how to plant his own corn or rice or weave his own fabric. It is love that will return the trillions spent by Wars R Us to the people who earned it in the first place. It is love that will follow the admonition of Jesus to dissolve the churches and relieve the priests of their authority over men. It is love that is the direct connection of man to God. The passion and desire of men can be healed instantly with this one lesson. We do not need to fight for anything anymore. We only need to love our own eternal soul. And by doing so, we will be capable and urged to love another eternal soul. And by doing so, we will already be loving God. These are the greatest commandments upon which hang all the laws and all the prophets. This is why I came here, and I am not alone. There are others who came here as well. They did not need to come. They were already finished with everything they could learn from mortality. We came back for the rest of you. It was impossible for us to look forward and upward while the rest of you were here. We cannot rest until every person in every corner of the earth who has faith in this truth gets this knowledge. Once you know this truth, no machine man can break your will and place a gun into your hand and tell you to point it at another being and kill them. No god of this or that, no president of this or that, no priest of this or that can conscribe you to their purpose. Peace, love, and joy, Earth Explorers. Now, tonight we have Neil Kramer coming on the program. We have about 13 minutes. We're going to bring him on. The reason I laid this first 15 minutes down, for those of you that are already Neil Kramer listeners or readers, as he has a couple of marvelous books out there. We're going to talk about one of those tonight. But I'm also impressed this week by various events that occurred, not the least of which was in Boston at the Boston Marathon. I've asked Neil to come on tonight to discuss with you deeper aspects of these events so that you are not swayed one way or the other by the press. You are not fed an idea or a concept by one news service or another so that you think you know what already happened. We are going to ask as a team, Neil and I, questions I promise you have not heard. And when you start thinking about these questions, the fabric of the net with which you have been ensnared is going to begin to unravel, and you're going to be free to figure it out for yourself. This may have been a piece of a well-crafted event. Some are calling it a false flag. It is not. It is not a false flag. It is something much bigger than that. Much bigger. And much more telling. And much more convicting than what you might imagine. So in about 11 minutes, we're going to bring you on. And then at the top of the hour, in about 41 minutes, we're going to open the phone lines. You can write them down now. The phone number toll-free anywhere in North America is 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. If you don't have a pen handy, get one handy. In about 30 minutes, we will give out the numbers again. Anywhere outside of America, if you are on planet or off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can get to us by dialing 530-413-9537. And if you have to go out tonight, you can still listen to the broadcast live by dialing 805-399-1000, 805-399-1000, and then the passcode 769-608 pound. And if you can't remember that, just go to X Squared Radio at x2-radio.com. There is a Droid app on the left-hand side of the screen. You just click on that X Squared Radio logo, and it will download the app to your phone, and you will 24 hours a day be one click away from the BBS Radio Network Channel 2, which is what we're broadcasting from right now. So in a little more than 9 minutes, we're going to bring Neil Kramer on. So if you know Neil Kramer, you've read his good work, you've been to a conference of his or listened to one of his broadcasts, call a friend right now and tell them to tune in. You can do this one of two ways. You can either go to bbsradio.com and click on Channel 2, or you can tell them to go to X Squared Radio at x2-radio.com and click the Listen link, and that will take you to bbsradio.com Channel 2. Either way, Twitter it out, Facebook it out. Right now, you've got 8 minutes, and Neil Kramer is going to be on with us. Now, the events that have occurred in the last week are not sudden. They're not a surprise. We have reason to believe that lots of people knew this was coming. And we're going to get into a lot of those details tonight. You're going to be able to ask your own questions, especially if you were somehow touched or involved or present at this event. You need to know these things because I'm sure, especially the people in Boston who were at the marathon, they have questions that are not being asked, and they're certainly not being answered in the current news media. And although I have great respect for Alex Jones and the great work that he has done and the great work that his reporters have done and his commentators have made, they didn't quite get there. They didn't quite figure it out. We did, and we're going to bring it to you. 7 more minutes, Neil Kramer and myself. Now, before we get too much further, I'm going to go ahead and get my commercials out of the way right now. If you go to X Squared Radio at x2-radio.com, one of the greatest investments that you can make right now, yes, you could buy silver, you could buy gold. The price is going down on both of those if you can find it. But the greatest investment is food. And this program has been now on the air. We're in our 8th year. This September, we will complete our 8th year on the air with BBS Radio Network, which right now is the largest webcast radio network on the web as far as number of hosts and number of hours of content available for you live 24 hours a day. During that 8 years, I have searched high and low, coast to coast, for a provider of emergency food supplies. Now, I'm not talking about the groceries that you put on your shelf. There are plenty of providers for that. Now, I'm not talking about MREs or canned food or any of the things you can get at your local Walmart or your local hardware store or at any of the local storage places. I'm talking about my good friends Scott and Danny out in Utah who developed a process for preserving food without preservatives. It's lightweight. It will keep for 30 years. It's delicious. It's gourmet stuff. We're not talking about dehydrated rice. We're talking about whole meals. You can set it and forget it. And this is the kind of quality of food that we want to represent. So if you go to x2-radio.com, on the right-hand side, you'll see our affiliates. At the very top is the food investor. If you really want to give a gift to your loved ones or your neighbors or yourself or your kids that will keep them out of the hands of FEMA when things go south, and that could be anything. It could be a fertilizer plant blowing up. It could be a tornado, a hurricane, a flood, a fire, a windstorm, or any other kind of event that requires you to flee your domicile with the clothes on your back and whatever you can carry. Invest in food with the food investor, put it in a book bag, put it in your front closet, and forget about it until you need to bug out. And when you do, grab that bag and you can take care of yourself. You'll have a water filter in there. You'll have plenty of food to take care of yourself, your spouse, your kids, and maybe a couple of neighbors for a month or so. That's what you need to take care of yourself. The food investor. That's what I invest in. My good friends Scott and Danny out in Utah. Okay, let's go ahead. I'm giving the high sign to the producer. Let's go ahead and bring Neil Kramer on. And he'll be on in about 2 minutes, and then we will begin this. You know, Neil has been a friend for a couple of years. We met a couple times, and most recently we spent quite a bit of time together at James Gilliland's ranch. Hello. Up at Trout Lake. And there's Neil. How are you doing, Neil?
I'm doing very well. Sorry, that was a rather unexpected entry there. Hello. Oh,
it's okay. He just walked into the studio. Not. He's at his house in Portland. We just brought him on via Skype. So, yeah, we met around a pretend bonfire at James Gilliland's. As you know, up there after, I think it's July 4th, you can't make a bonfire because of forest fire rules.
That's right, yeah.
So we had an imaginary bonfire, and we stood around it and talked for several hours, as late as our bones could take the cold.
Mm.
And fast friends immediately. So he's been on the show before, and tonight we have an event for which his passion is uniquely suited. The Boston Marathon terror attack really took a lot of people by surprise. When we saw it on Drudge and we went to the newspapers, it was, you know, instantly the number one story. And the one thing that I guess that struck everybody was the 2 or 3 days of trying to figure out who did it and why. And it wasn't really the investigators that found it. It was viewers that found it based on all the footage that was there. They identified two guys that were going in the wrong direction from everybody else, and they just happened to be Chechenian brothers. And, you know, we watched with the same amusement as everybody else, but yeah. I'm a scientist, and Neil is a philosopher who's also an analytical thinker. And some pieces just didn't fit, did they, Neil?
No, they didn't. They really didn't. And as I heard you say in your introduction before, that it's not quite as simple enough to say that this is just a false flag. It is disgraceful. There are PSYOP elements, psychological operational elements to this. It's very surreal as well. And to begin with, I mean, I'm still really examining the events of Sandy Hook. And before, you know, one can draw conclusions about that, we're already on to the next, you know, unusual event. So I'm still sort of processing that. And just on that note, one of the other commentators on Sandy Hook, and he was a critic of how it was portrayed in the corporate media, a guy called James Tracy, is finally taking flack from his employers at the university in Florida over there for speaking about this. So they waited 3 months and then they had a go at this guy. So his university don't like that at all. So this is relevant to what we're talking about. You know, it's not hard to understand why the corporate media don't really want any free speech on this, because you can't have academics and media people from within the institutional framework questioning the fabric of reportage itself, you know, the actual way we report news. You can have sort of lefty intellectuals, as many as you like, pondering the state of the world, you know, the Noam Chomskys of this world, as sharp and clever as they are, but they aren't really rocking the boat. They're not really questioning the very reality of the substructure itself. They're not doubting the foundations. They're still playing the same chessboard with the same pieces, and they haven't really been able to move away from that. We choose to do things differently. I think that's how I would differentiate myself, to say I'm not playing with the pieces that have been issued to me, and I'm not shuffling them around on the board that's been issued to me. I have dispensed with that. And I might throw, you know, a rook and a knight around now and again in order to engage with someone who operates within that paradigm. But that does not constitute my personal way of transacting with the world. So, as you say, here we are with this another further episode of what I would describe as sort of dark sorcery, really. A sorcery of the human mind, which... The headline is, you know, 3 people dead and 180 plus injured, some very seriously. And as it happens, just to put that in perspective, on the exact same day, 56 people were killed in Iraq and 300 others injured. But that's in a funny place far away that we don't care about. So those kind of things just disappear. And every day, people today killed in Damascus, all kinds of stuff going on. So this is just another killing somewhere in the world. What's unusual about this, though, is that aside from the real human story, and I was in Boston just last year, so, you know, it's not difficult to remember when my feet were walking on that ground. You know, real people died, and lots of families and communities have had their lives turned upside down, all because of 2 bombs at the finish line of a race. You know, what a strange world we live in. And, of course, that's what we're going to examine tonight and try and draw some conclusions about this. And for me, it points to not just this event, but what it tells us about our reality. And, again, I think you're wise to caution people against jumping into what Alex Jones and David Icke or whatever are saying. Again, though they do important work, for me, the best way to deal with these sort of situations is to understand that first we have to collect data and analyze it, compare it to similar existing data, and then if we have the gift of a couple of decades of experience under our belt already, then we can begin to draw some conclusions, but not about anything other than what actually happened, not what we think happened or what might have happened, but what did happen. And only when that's been established, only then can we then move on to draw some alternative conclusions and map out some other scenarios and motivations and methodologies and so on. So we have to be very careful not to swamp the forums and the websites and social media with rubbish, with, you know, half-baked silly ideas and rants, because I know we feel strongly about this. But that sort of thing doesn't help. It just obscures our ability to present credible alternative news. So I think the very first thing one has to do is stand back from the hype. Before you do anything else, stand back from the hype. And I'm sure you feel the same way, Brooks.
Sure. I mean, I try to look at the facts of this, not what the, you know, reporters are saying or what the pundits are saying. And there are 2 facts. These are direct observations that anyone can make for themselves. First of all, there are lots and lots of marathons everywhere, all over the world, all over the United States. There was a marathon in Nashville just last month. My son ran at it. However, there have been no other marathons with full-scale Department of Homeland Security contractor drills for bomb scares. The Boston Marathon, what we know about it, number one, is that the government funded and managed a terror drill facilitated at the Boston Marathon, and it may have numbed the bystanders. That is to say, given them a false sense of security that all these 300 or 400 special agents were around with bomb sniffing dogs and, you know, agents and people on top of buildings looking down with binoculars. It may have made the people feel safe that nothing bad could happen. No one could believe that this next point, the next observation, might be the only other possibility. And that is that the bombs were placed and detonated by operatives either running the drill, or that those operatives, all those agents, were there because they knew that these bombs were going to be placed and they were going to try and stop them. They didn't know who was going to place them, but they knew they were going to be placed. They had credible chatter that one was going to be placed, and they were trying to stop it, and they didn't. And because they didn't, they denied that they were ever conducting a drill. Now, those are the facts. That's what the news media is not telling us.
They are the facts, and it is important when you observe an event like this to immediately gain context for it. And the context for this, you can place this directly alongside 9/11 and the London subway bombings and the Norway attacks, Aurora, Colorado, Sandy Hook, Taft Union, in that all of them also had live fire terrorist drills in the same location or nearby on the same day. So any mainstream thinker or any alternative thinker, any free thinker, any traditional thinker, anyone presented with that to say, consider these very serious terrorist or nutter incidents or whatever you want to call it, and let's look at the commonalities. And the commonalities are, number one, that before you say anything else, there were live training drills, just like on 9/11. FEMA training exercises placed personnel in New York City on September the 10th. And on the day of 9/11, the Joint Chiefs of Staff and NORAD were conducting a joint live fly hijack field training exercise, something they called an FTX, which involves aircraft under US control posing as hijacked airliners. That's a fact, right? That's a fact. And that's not reported in the mainstream media in 2001. Just in the same manner that right now, the drill part of this isn't being reported. The unusual thing about this event is that unlike 2001, there is a huge torrent of independent information gathering happening in an event like this because of technology largely and networking tools that allow people to share information. So in that vein, there's another thing we have to just be a little careful of. I see another technique being used here by the what I call the control system, and it's one that has been used from about 1996 onwards, when the internet first came into popular usage, and that is swamping the sort of infosphere with junk, right? So you cannot really see what is going on, even if you ask the question. So as well as bots doing that, and when I say a bot, that's like a little program that mimics human information so it can post on forums and blogs and tweets and whatnot, there are also paid disinformation agents, one of whom I have met in New York City, who do their level best to stir things up, you know, to muddy the waters, to discredit important information and researchers and sort of generally cause trouble. And that's very definitely occurring on a previously unseen scale with this Boston Marathon bombing. There's so much data out there that it is virtually impossible to get to the good stuff if you don't already know where to look. So if you do know that there are, whatever, a dozen, two dozen excellent, disciplined, experienced, wise-thinking people out there who will give you a fair report of what is going on, then you can go to those, check them out, and make your own mind up. But if you're just some mainstream news consumer and you go along and hit Google and type in Boston Marathon, you know, alternative theories, your first 100 results will likely be a load of rubbish, a carefully managed list of nonsense. You know, one or two good things in there, sure, maybe, but most of it rubbish. And so at that point, our mainstream brothers and sisters throw in the towel. They give up the fight and say, oh, well, whatever. You know, I'll just go on and have a look at CNN and BBC. So it does fall upon anyone who is saying substantial, reasoned, insightful things about events like this to keep our information and our methodology as sharp as we possibly can. And I'm sure, you know, we'll do our best tonight to do that. But that information has made it difficult to control this event. So rather than try and suppress it all, which is unrealistic, instead what they do is, as well as the jigsaw that we're trying to piece together, they've thrown in 55 other jigsaws and mixed all the pieces up.
yeah, that's right. I could see that, where they just, you know, mix it up with so much other misinformation that it's difficult to sift through it all. And that's why it really takes, you know, a scientific mind, philosopher, to step back from it and say, wait a minute. Of all the marathons that have been, why did you pick this one to spend $500,000 putting highly trained anti-terror operatives and agents and highly trained people on the street at the finish line, especially, and there were lots of them photographed, you know, by various means, different cameras, different cell phones, different surveillance cameras. They're there. All the agents are there. They're standing on rooftops. They have dogs. Why were they at this Boston Marathon? Why were there so many wheelchairs and gurneys ready to go to just pick people up within 60 seconds? They were there. Why was all this ready to go if they did not have credible information that there was going to be some sort of attack at this? Now, where would they get this credible information? From two brothers that just cooked up this idea and literally some cookware and hauled it down in some book bags left over from their honor roll activities at college to place down on the curb? Is that where they got the information, enough to mobilize that many men and that much surveillance and that much anti-terror training?
Yeah.
It just doesn't make sense.
It doesn't. And right there, you can just make that statement to any concerned, you know, Bostonian. Is that the right way of saying it? For someone who lives in Boston. Anybody who is connected with that, and particularly the people nearby or who have friends and family there, you can say you have the legitimate and understandable privilege of investigating your own information on this and to get to the reality of it. And the very first thing you must do, aside from the, some of the cautions that we've outlined, is say there was prior knowledge of this event. Number one, there was prior knowledge. So straight away, that discredits all mainstream corporate media news broadcasting who aren't telling us that. So you've got a problem straight away for the mainstream thinker, which is, well, hang on a minute. All the news agencies, the New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, MSNBC, everybody, BBC, Guardian, everybody, are not going into that. They're not going into that element of the story, which is there was an enormous piece of infrastructure placed there beforehand. Why is that and what was going on? And as you say, not only can we observe that, but we can also observe that the authorities, in quotes, are denying that, which again is a cause for concern for me.
Well, when we talk about a cause for concern, it is one thing to say, okay, you know, the bubble-headed bleach blonde at Fox News doesn't get it, and she's not going to ask these questions even if she is a lawyer that never lost a case in her life. But we are hearing officials like the chief of police and other official commentators, official spokespeople saying we had no credible evidence that anything like this was going to occur. We already can see from the evidence ourselves that you're lying. The question is, why are you lying? Are you lying so that the blood of the 8-year-old boy that was killed isn't on your hands? Mm. It's okay to say to the people, look, we kind of knew something like this was going to happen. We decided not to take a chance. We mobilized everything we had, and we couldn't stop it. And we're sorry. What's wrong with telling the truth?
Yeah, you often see with these events that they have a ready-to-go scenario, and sometimes they pull it back, and sometimes they make it disappear, and sometimes they let it go. Sometimes they let it transpire with all the little kind of Timothy McVeighs and Lee Harvey Oswalds and whatnot. And it's kind of a tried and tested method. I think, you know, let's work backwards a little bit for a minute. The scale of, and I'll use a media word, the manhunt for this and the city shutdown is very relevant here. It's very, very relevant, this. The whole transport system suspended, the city in shutdown, Black Hawk helicopters doing low sweeps over civilian areas.
The cell phones were shut off.
Military convoys moving in Humvees through residential neighborhoods. To see that on television is one of the key aspects of this exercise. Shutting down, you know, a 4-mile stretch of streets between Cambridge and Watertown, because, as they say, they could have been littered with unexploded devices and whatnot. And the you know, the guy saying, I just want to speak to the community, we need your help, we're asking everyone to take shelter, stay indoors, speak to the police, you know, open up your homes as is necessary. That kind of exercise is very relevant here because it's acclimatizing people to the idea that the authorities and the security forces are heroes and are very important what they do. And you have to say, of course, that a lot of the cops and paramedics and army guys or whatever are stand-up, excellent people, and they know nothing about this. They think they're doing an excellent job and they're trying their best. I appreciate that. We understand that. But let me just say this to people. Let me tell you something that you may or may not know. Every major nation has special forces units, whether private or military, that specialize, right, specialize in killing people. That's all they do. They're not necessarily the teams you see talked about on the Discovery Channel. You know, they're not that kind of thing. We're talking about something a little more direct here. And these teams eliminate other human beings. That's all they do. And that is what they're employed to do. And they do it supremely well with massive efficiency, anytime, anywhere. America have these kill teams. Britain have them, France, Germany, Israel, Russia, Italy, Austria, everyone, every major player has them. And it doesn't matter where the targets are for these teams. With the technology that we have now to trace unique EM signatures, DNA signatures permanently anywhere across the planet, to tag someone and be able to pick them up in any location, anywhere. They could be walking down the street, driving down the freeway, sat inside a building, on the subway, in an aeroplane, in a forest, anywhere. We can see them. And once they've been located, they can be killed by remote stealth weapons or locally using overwhelming brute force immediately. So total removal of the targets. Anyone who happens to be in the way will also be removed. No questions asked, no laws. No paperwork, no conventions, none of that. Just now, massive lethal force.
We've been doing that in Pakistan on a weekly basis.
Exactly. These people would be instantly killed and the remains transported away without anyone ever knowing about it. So the spectacle, Brooks, the spectacle of a sort of Wild West gunfight with the local cops is suspicious to me. The planners of this caper must have been watching this one with popcorn and big smiles on the faces. This is not how we take real threats to the nation down. We don't do it like that. It's not how it's done. Speak to anybody with military knowledge and they'll tell you that I'm right. We don't mess around when we want someone dead. You might have to pussyfoot around with a world leader or a political figure to give the appearance, you know, of abiding by international law. But when it's just some dude, some radicals, some nut jobs or patsies or disaffected scapegoats, they are instantly terminated and you never know about it. So we have to observe that the emergency manhunt, city shutdown, cop shootout is a fiction, a movie, a piece of sort of real life theatre for the people, and it preparing them mentally for future larger scale operations to acclimatise them to control, essentially. So it's a very old story, this, that our colleagues in the field have been telling us about for ages. And as I say, let me emphasise this. This is very important. It's not to say that the cops involved aren't doing it for real in their own hearts. They're just good guys trying to do their jobs here. They know nothing about what's going on, the real operation. They are clueless. To them, it's another bad guy that they need to grab. So I appreciate that. But it gives the impression that there are these dirty, foreigner, terrorist people spoiling our freedoms, jealous of our way of life, and we need to do something about it. We need to take them out. The president says it's okay. As you point out, Brooks, he does it every day himself with men, women, and children all around the planet. So this is fiction, and we know it's fiction, and we're not accepting it. And gladly, more and more people are not accepting it either. So we have to, hand on heart, say we can't trust a word from the mouth of the corporate media. That's very important. You have to accept that, even though it's difficult. And even the nice people who are still around in that strange world, we have to assume they've been compromised. So however grown up and convincing and commendable, as you say, you know, they might be lawyers and professionals and brain surgeons and politicians and congressmen and women, however well-meaning they are, they're not in a position to help us. So we have to exclude the corporate media from the equation of actually acquiring truth here. And for some listeners, they think, yeah, we know that, but you know that how difficult that is for our friends and family who are normal. They can't do that. So that's why you see people in the streets chanting USA, USA, which is always a very ugly sight, believe me, because Europeans, when they see that, they know what that leads to, which is consensual slavery, because that nationalism isn't true-hearted patriotism. It's brainwashing. And when you see that, it's a very disturbing sight as someone who comes from a country who's been suppressed for 2,000 years. You know, we don't want to see that happen anywhere else.
Well, it's one thing to hear it when you're at a hockey game in the Olympics. But it's another when a dissenter stands up and tells the president something like, what about the 286 children that were killed in Pakistan this last year by your drones? And then presidential, I don't know what you call them, spear catchers begin chant USA, USA to drown out the dissenter. Yeah. And then the dissenter simply hauled out under the NDAA, never to be heard from again. Yeah. That's why I played the Charlie Chaplin speech at the beginning from the film.
Yeah, I heard that, yeah.
Because this world without nations, this world without borders, this taking down all the patriotism of every single country has been tried since the beginning of time by force. It's been tried by armies. It's been tried by churches with equally devastating results, resulting in age-old feuds that are never going to end. We're never going to have peace in the Middle East because of it. The only way out of this is love. The only way out of this is love. You cannot kill your way out of this. You can't create the ultimate police state, like Neil is saying, where your individual DNA, once it's identified, can be tracked down by a hunter, seeker, killer drone, which is going to follow you to the furthest reaches of the earth and kill you. Because your mortal life is a threat to the peace and tranquility of their organization. There are a lot of things specifically about the events that have happened less than the last year. We could start with Benghazi and go on, where innocent people have been murdered. The ability to protect them was stayed or held back. And even those leaders that tried to disobey orders and send in relief were immediately relieved of duty and basically taken to the brig.
Yeah, Benghazi is an absolute disgrace. That should bring down the current administration, but people don't care enough about it. It's only like the sort of political right-wingers who are keeping that alive at the moment.
Well, you have the whistleblowers that are now testifying this week and next week. And you have the Secretary of State, the current one, Mr. Kerry, saying, oh, come on, this is old news.
Let's move on, yeah.
Let's move on.
That's a direct quote, isn't it? Let's move on, he said, I think.
Yeah, let's move on. So, and that's the way it is, and that's the way it'll be with Boston. In a few weeks, they'll say, look, that little boy is buried. Those families have finished their grieving. This guy is going to be tried, this 19-year-old. He's going to be interrogated. He's never going to get to speak to a reporter. He's never going to be seen again. In fact, I have it on good authority. He's probably going to commit suicide in his cell. We're never going to hear from him. And in 6 months, we'll say, look, let's move on. That was a terrible incident. Let's move on. It's time, people, that we ask these questions. And we keep asking them until we get the truth. One of the other things I wanted to add, the elder brother, Tamerlan, was out of the country for more than 6 months. And a lot of you don't know this. Neil probably knows this. But if you're here on this country on a green card and you leave the country for more than 6 months, you can have your green card pulled and you move to the back of the line for U.S. citizenship.
That's right.
Tamerlan was out of the country for 6 months and he came back in the country and not a question was asked. They gave him a pass and let him come in the country. And within weeks, he was planning the bombing, the Boston Marathon.
It's all very unlikely, isn't it? It really is.
You know, even engineers, foreign nationals, Indians and Jordanians that are engineers that work for American contractors, they have their green card. If they leave the country, go back to their home country, work in the oil fields or nuclear power or something like that, they're gone for more than 6 months. Even their green cards are put in question and they're moved.
I've had to be very careful about mine and my legitimate movements of, you know, speaking to people and doing spiritual work and spiritual teaching work. I have to be careful with that because it disappears. It's funny though, just one point on that you talk very philosophically about having borders and having no borders and having one great big lovely world with everyone holding hands, you know, presented as a sort of control system ideal. It's funny that because let me say that there's this guy called Peter Gandalovich, who is a Czech politician, but he's also the Czech Republic ambassador to the United States. And he had to announce recently, publicly, that the Czech Republic is not Chechnya. And the reason he felt he had to do that was because there were millions of Americans who were struggling with the notion that these two places were actually not the same place, because they thought that the Czech Republic sounded very like Chechen. So we know. Now, I know that some of the wonderful American public out there can occasionally be a bit geographically spasticated, I'm afraid. Not that your wonderful educated audience is, but lots of people, to be fair, from Britain and Spain and Brazil or wherever, would probably not be entirely sure, to be honest, where to point on a map if I said, where is Chechnya? Well, Chechnya is part of Russia's northern Caucasus region. So if you go to the continent of Europe, let's say you're American, you go to Europe, come in on the western shore, or let's say, you know, you start at France and then go eastwards into Austria and Hungary and Romania, then go south a bit into Bulgaria, and then east again into Turkey and Armenia, and then up a bit into Georgia, and then you're there, you come to Chechnya and Dagestan and all these funny places. And on the left, you've got the Black Sea. And on the right, you've got the Caspian Sea, right? A very remote but very fascinating part of the world, this. And here's an interesting thing. If you go into Google Maps or Bing Maps or whatever and look at that region, it's not properly mapped and labeled. It doesn't look like everywhere else. There are a lot of blank spaces because nobody knows what's going on there. Nobody knows what the official story is of what to call things. There is no consensus on what is what and who, what belongs to who. So although it's ostensibly Russian, it sort of isn't as well. So a group of guys in that region have said basically that large parts of that land were invaded by Russia in the 18th century and so are now disputed. And much of that rebellion is being led by a man called Doku Umarov, who looks very much like a young Fidel Castro, actually. And to some, he's a sort of butcher and terrorist, and to others, he's a glorious rebel leader. And you have to think yourself what you make of that. But he thinks the West is hypocritical and illogical and murderous in its foreign policy. And he's got a point, of course he has. But, you know, running around in the mountains, blowing people up is perhaps not the best way to win friends and influence people, is it? But that whole region is very unstable, and that instability translates, if you look at it in Google Maps. Check that out. Maybe not while we're trying to concentrate on this conversation, but have a look at it. It's very, very interesting.
Well, you're exactly right. And the fact that Tamerlan was able to travel outside the country and then to travel to these areas, which became of concern to Moscow. In fact, I believe it was Putin that alerted the FBI, you need to talk to this guy when he gets back into your country, because he visited a group in Chechen that is known to train terrorists. And ostensibly, the FBI interviewed him and found out everything was okay. But for some reason, they give Tamerlan and his younger brother a pass. And they let him come into the country. They let him plan this bombing. And someone inside the government was making sure these two young men had money, access, and were able to sneak past hundreds of professionals with bomb-sniffing dogs to place two chemical bombs curbside and then leave the scene. It was private citizens scanning the footage that found the terrorists, not government analysis. Even Janet Napolitano said they were not suspects. This is the story that we got from the government, but public participation forced their hand and they had to take action. It was Drudge that put their pictures on the cover of Drudge Report and said, find these guys.
Yeah.
They said within 5 minutes of that being placed on Drudge Report, the leads began pouring in. It was not a government effort. It was a private effort that found these two kids.
Yeah, that's very telling, isn't it? Do we have to break at the hour, or can we go on?
Let's take a quick break.
Okay.
We'll take a 4.5-minute break here, and then when we come back, we'll open up the phone lines. So don't go away. More X Squared Radio coming to you right after this. welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, and we're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. My guest tonight is Neil Kramer, philosopher, author of The Unfoldment. We'll let you know how you get a copy of that book here in just a moment. If you're already listeners of and readers of Neil Kramer, you already know him. He's been on the program now a couple of times, and we always welcome his fresh philosophy and his ability to read through the smokescreen of the press. I want to let you know that if you're getting ready to prepare for your family, you've got your tax money back and you're ready to make an investment, I would suggest going to the Food Investor at X Squared Radio, x2-radio.com. Up in the right-hand side, there's a banner that says The Food Investor. My friends Scott and Danny out in Utah have developed a process without preservatives to protect food for 30 years. Talk about set it and forget it. You just put this food in a book bag by the front door, and if you should happen to have the need to get out of your house in a hurry, you can take care of yourself and maybe your loved ones and a neighbor as well. Invest in food. It's a smart idea. Last fall, we had an attack on our embassy in Libya. As you know, the ambassador and his staff lost their lives in this event. Of course, the ambassador wasn't just summarily killed. He was humiliated in the worst, most disgraceful Arab fashion possible. And when the orders came in, the information came in to AFRICOM. General Carter Ham, who was the head of AFRICOM, received the same emails the White House received from the embassy requesting help and support as the attack was taking place. General Ham immediately had a rapid response unit ready and communicated to the Pentagon that he had a unit ready. General Ham then received the order to stand down. His response? Screw it. He was going to help anyhow. He knew his men were on the ground. He knew there were diplomats on the ground. And he knew that every second counted. So he gave the order. And within not a minute, within 30 seconds, after making the move to respond, his second in command apprehended General Ham and told him that he was now relieved of his command. Now, GRU analysts in this report state that Obama's greatest fear during the 11 September terrorist attack on the American consulate in Benghazi was that a strong U.S. military response would hurt his reelection chances, as the American people's appetite for war has all but disappeared. And he would also be open to attacks from his far-left base, who remain firmly opposed to further U.S. military action in the Middle East. And there was another, an admiral. I believe you pronounce his last name Gawet. He grew up in San Diego, graduated from the University of California. He was in the Navy under the Submarine Strategic Weapons Program. He was a commissioned officer at the Candidate School in 1982, graduated with honors. He served as a navigator, damage control assistant in USS Arthur Radford, combat systems officer in USS Fletcher, commissioning combat systems officer in USS Port Royal, and executive officer in the USS Paul Hamilton. He's a graduate of the Air War College. He earned a concurrent master's degree in public administration from Auburn University. He was awarded the Vice Admiral James Bond Stockdale Award for inspirational leadership in recognition of the hard work by the crew of the USS Oldendorf, which he commanded from 2001 through 2003. He's the recipient of various personal decorations and unit awards. The shocking report prepared by the Foreign Military Intelligence Main Directorate of the General Staff of the Armed Forces and circulating in the Kremlin states that President Obama fired him, fired the Navy's most powerful admiral over growing fears that the U.S. military is planning an overthrow of his government. Now, this is the kind of thing that would build, and it would build momentum in a big way. Now we have this political snafu, which is called sequestration. A lot of you have wrestled with that term. If you've ever been to the Pentagon, you've ever hung out with military people, you see they wear this little badge. It says sequestration with the red circle with the hash mark through it, meaning that they don't want it to happen. This was a political deal that was made, a sort of fail-safe, a trapdoor, a suicide pact, that if we don't come to some kind of agreement on a budget, then we'll take across-the-board cuts, which would have devastating effects on the U.S. military, the people down at Wars R Us. So it makes sense that there is a dichotomy, there's a division, there is a test of wills. Not unlike what there was when Patton wanted to chase the Russians, you know, north out of Berlin so that we would not have the wall. And, of course, he was summarily relieved from duty. Maybe not like that. But now we have a test of wills between the people who want to protect the Constitution and the people who want to protect the president. And that's what I want to talk about this hour with my good friend Neil Kramer. Are we seeing a philosophical difference in the way government is beginning to rule the people?
Yes. Yes, we are. There's no other way to answer that question. We are seeing a situation where the idea that the government is the boss is becoming accepted for large parts of the American population. The truth of the matter is that the government have one job and one job only, which is to serve the people. And that is consistently forgotten, absolutely consistently forgotten. As I pointed out in my essay about Margaret Thatcher's demise recently, all too quickly do people assume that the person sat in 10 Downing Street or Capitol Hill or whatever, that they're the boss. They're the boss man. And that's not true. They are a public servant, in a manner of speaking. That high public office is a privilege to be able to carry out the will of the people. And that will is formulated in accordance with, in America, the written constitution. And I have never seen such flagrant disregard for that constitution as I have in the last 12 months, where people... movie stars, musicians, politicians, directors, artists are saying, we need to get rid of the Second Amendment. It's a disgrace. Guns kill people, and let's get rid of it. And freedom of speech is okay as long as it doesn't offend anybody, you know, so we have to make some amendments to that. That's very troublesome. It's very dangerous, that. And as I don't want to cover the ground that we did last time we spoke, but having a written constitution, the word written, is very, very significant, because without that, the way that's codified becomes enmeshed into the infrastructure of government, i.e. they decide what bear arms means. What do those words mean? To keep and bear arms. That isn't decided by the document. It's decided by committees in Washington, D.C. That's what happens in England, listeners. That's what currently happens in England. England have a constitution, but it is unwritten now, and it is uncodified now. And so the details of the British constitution no longer belong to the people. They are codified and encoded and encrypted, you might even say, in a law that is far removed from human life. So having a First and Second Amendment in particular, and standing true to what they say, because I think they work rather well, is really, really important. And to have human beings separated out in a way where people are saying, well, you know, the Constitution is some sort of strange historical document, we don't need to worry too much about that, is very stupid, really. And even going back to when we were just discussing the dumping of bad information regarding the Boston Marathon event, you know, the LA Times ran a piece yesterday where they characterized anybody who was looking for the truth of what was happening in Boston as homebrew CSI people playing Sherlock Holmes, spreading paranoia, etc. And what they also did rather cleverly, and this is relevant to what we're talking about now, is that they suggested that alternative analysis is usually the work of either Muslim extremists or right-wing extremists. Do you see what is happening there? They're taking two opposite ends of the spectrum and joining them together into the same disreputable threat, extremism. So to have an extreme view, regardless of what it is bad. The thought being that, you know, extremism is the enemy, i.e. if you stand out of normality, you become a threat to national security. That is what they're trying to pull with this thing. And I've never seen such a inhumane sort of dictator as Obama, I have to say. And it saddens me to drive around Portland, which is a very beautiful and wonderful city with a lot of humanly liberal. I don't want to use that word always in the sort of pejorative sense, because one can fall into that if you're not careful. But real liberal-minded people, i.e., you know, to live and let live. You see a lot of Obama Biden stickers on people's cars, which is very, very stupid, very saddening, really, because it means that they're still playing the sort of old game. So I think that the elements that, you know, I'd like to move on to is, you know, what are some of the reasons behind this? You know, how does this work? There's this guy called Murray Jennings, who's a crisis management person at San Diego University, and they, in this article in the LA Times, were suggesting that online voices enabled by the internet, beyond the photos that we upload, our speculation isn't very helpful. So they're trying to discredit the fact that really people who get on the internet and do radio shows and have websites and write articles who aren't academically approved in some instances, you rather much are than I am, Brooks, but independent voices are not relevant when unapproved. That's a very stark difference that I've not seen illustrated quite like that before.
It's unscientific. It's very unscientific. You know, I don't mind being an extreme scientist. I guess I can be true.
But that's good. ExtremeScientist.com. You should get that one.
Because the scientific method is so pure. It's so godlike. It's asks questions, forms a hypothesis, develops experiments to prove or disprove the hypothesis, and from that can formulate a theory. And if the theory holds long enough, then it becomes an axiom or a postulate or even a fact. In fact, facts can be discovered while you're doing the experimentation. Oh, this is what happens when you mix this with that. But it is pretty clear when you see actions that are taken by individuals in the government, I won't say the government, but by individuals in the government, that the motivation for taking that action is more than just trying to protect one simple ambassador in Libya. That could have been done in a matter of minutes. We could have spirited our ambassador out of there, and we could have protected the lives there and moved on from that. But we didn't. We let them die. We watched them die live on camera, and it wasn't a quick death. It was slow and torturous. It took hours. I can't believe that there were bureaucrats in Washington that sat there watching that camera and, like you said before, eating popcorn. I just can't believe it. But
well, go ahead.
Well, when I speak to government officials, and I'm talking about a sitting senator, and a sitting senator tells me, you know, when the nation was young, we needed strong states because we had a very weak central government. We needed state militias, otherwise the nation couldn't defend itself. But now we have a very strong central government. We have a very strong federal government, and we don't need those states' rights anymore. That is the thinking of a government, not an individual in the government. That's the mainstream thought in the halls of Congress today.
It is, and it's when you get to that threshold that the government starts to openly proclaim itself as not the administrative arm of the people, i.e. to help organize human beings effectively, but as a separate authority. And even with that Benghazi thing, I think that the aftermath of that is very important, just like the aftermath of the Boston event is very important. Because if you look at these, the psychological effects of this, and that's, you know, PSYOPs comes from British military terminology originally, which is bloody typical, really. You know, what are they for? Well, amongst other things, these psychological operations, they program the unawakened collective consciousness, the minds of the people, you might say, to consent to militarization, basically. The idea that war and freedom go together, which ties up right to what you were saying at the top of the program, Brooks.
Right, right.
To willingly hand over the idea that we don't need peace, because actually somebody somewhere has got to get punished all the time if we want to enjoy our freedoms. That's exactly what Romans used to think. They knew, members of middle-class Roman society knew, or thought they knew, that somewhere somebody had to get their head crushed if they were to enjoy their freedoms. And of course, that's no truth. That's not true. And though the, you know, you might say the carnage from the actual marathon bombing was low, not that that's any consolation to the poor people who died and were injured, that's not important to the planners. What matters to them is the aftermath, the subsequent security operations, and how that's portrayed in the media and the TV. During one of these operations, boy, oh boy, the television is barely watchable. It is a disgrace to humanity. It revels in the sensationalism. It loves it. That is highly irresponsible. It's also inaccurate. It's biased. It's scaremongering. It's lascivious. But that's exactly how it's meant to be. So from a human angle, I mean, I've had a number of emails from people following this event with their thoughts and concerns. And one of the major common problems, and this from a lady, hello, Andrea, if you're listening, from someone, you know, right there affected by that, really. One of the amazing souls who's taking themselves seriously in this world was saying it's very difficult to look around the people you love and care about and the people you work with and the people that you're affiliated with in commerce or whatever and see that they just eat up the official story without any further analysis. And that is very difficult. The official story is all that exists sometimes for some of those people. And anything else is disrespectful. And I think we have to be very, very careful not to allow that to go any further. Because throughout any history, I mean, I could list off 50 similar precedents for this, you have to allow what you would consider as your First Amendment rights to absolutely remain inviolable. They have to be there. If they don't, what starts off as nationalism, just like in Germany in the 1930s, very, very quickly, in a matter of 5 short years, turns into fascism. And I'm not exaggerating, because we often throw those words around, don't we, and sometimes in our work, but I'm not exaggerating when I say that. I mean nationalism of that nature, where you don't want to know what's going on, you really don't want to know, you just want somebody to tell you, that sort of nationalism where you've got absolute good and absolute evil leads immediately to fascism. And I think that you could say one very interesting part of this is that one thing that we can see is that, you know, we all know the faces, right, of one of our enemies, one of the empire's enemies, Muslims, brown skin, black fuzzy beards, you know, funny headwear, pale robes, a neck scarf, whatever. You know, the Muslim fundamentalist demon like Bin Laden or al-Zafawi or whatever. Well, now, with this bombing, we have been presented with massively distributed images of new enemies with a new racial profile, a new terrorist physiognomy, right? These young men with distinct ethnic features and particular colouring and hair, the shape of their eyes and their noses and their mouths and their lips and their eye colouring, the whole thing, a representative, you know, slice of that part of the world. These images are prepping people to say, look, these are also the new bad guys, people who look like this. these are the people who we'll be killing in the future. We might even be going over there to bomb them and set up bases. And I have to say, on a human level, yesterday, right, a young man sat in a place a few tables over from me having lunch with his girlfriend. He was the spitting image of the young lad who was, you know, one of these guys. He was the spitting image of the young Chechen lad. And he looked very sheepish indeed when he was sat there. And I noticed that a few other people, Americans in the place, were eyeing him suspiciously, quite innocently and understandably thinking, you know, that lad over there, he looks just like the guy from the Boston Marathon bombings. So it's already working. People are already looking at that ethnic category of human being and thinking,
There's no doubt about it. I have a business associate who runs an auto supply company. And he drives everywhere in this country. And I said, why do you drive everywhere? Why don't you fly? He said, that's easy for you to say. But I have exactly the same facial features as one of Saddam Hussein's sons.
Holy cow, yeah.
I have been stopped and searched at every airport for so many years, I'm sick of it. So I drive everywhere.
Well, you know, if that isn't evidence to me, you know, do we need any more proof that humanity, not just how we consider the Constitution and the government, but humanity itself is splitting off into two groups? Do we need any more proof? You know, are we breathing and seeing here and feeling what is really going on in the real world? Can we see the chasm, the bifurcation, the divergence of the species? Can we see that? You know, there is a huge gap between those who want to know and those who do not want to know. And when I say know, I mean know anything. Themselves, their world, their life, their history, their science, their spiritual origins, their galactic community, whatever you want to say. And those who do not want to know, who do not want to know any of this stuff, they just want it to all go away. Leave them alone in peace. The world is what it is and it's not our place to question it. Better to say nothing. And they cling to this ignorance desperately, violently. They cling to this sleep. And it is a sleep of protection, this cocooning away from truth. And I say, as anyone who knows me will know, leave them to it. If you feel the fire inside you, forget those people and move on. Keep the company of those who are awakening like you. And of course, we have compassion for those people. And we can, as I sometimes say, love them from a distance. And we can work with them as best we can and gently leave doors open at the right time for the right people. You know, your choice, do what you do. There are no wrong answers in this. There are only movements of consciousness. And we are choosing to move our consciousness to say, this isn't good enough. We can do better than this. And it's true now that the people in Downing Street, in Parliament, in Capitol Hill, in the administration, the Congress, the Senate, largely no longer represent us. They do not. We have moved on from that now, and we have to do something about that.
Yeah, we've got to get back to the Republic. I want to get back to that thought you were bringing up about fascism, because when I played Charlie Chaplin's speech from The Greatest Dictator, this is exactly the kind of rhetoric, the kind of ability, the oration,
yeah,
that whipped the people up into following.
Yeah, them. Yeah.
I will fight for you. I will fight for German rights. I will fight for German sovereignty. I will get Germany out from underneath the reparations from the Treaty of Versailles. You know, these are the kinds of comments that the German people wanted to hear and they were willing to fight for. Now, what we have in this country is we have rhetoric. I will lead you out from underneath the oppressive thumb of the wealthy. I will, you know, take their 401ks, which have far too much money. Nobody needs any more than $203,000 a year. We'll take the excess of that money and we'll distribute it to those people who are less fortunate because it's the right thing to do. And, of course, the poor far outweigh the rich. And so they say, hey, that's a great idea. I get some of Warren Buffett's 401k. Not bad. I like the idea. So it begins by eliminating one type of individual, and that's called the armed American. The armed American is the enemy of the state.
Yeah. Now, let me just stop you there, Brooks, right? 5 years ago, before I had on-the-ground experience of American life, if I'd have heard someone like you say that, I'd think, oh, these Americans and the guns, you know, there's something kind of funny about that, and there's these funny men in camo pants running around in the desert like, you know, Dale Gribble from King of the Hill. You know, survivalist, crazy guys.
Right.
Now, I admit that that view is uniquely European because, by and large, guns have been removed completely from the UK from really the sort of all my life, completely gone. And I think it's very wise for anyone who has a question about that, because when you and I talked last time, I took a right load of flack for being pro-gun, pro-choice, as you might say, pro-Second Amendment. People couldn't believe it, some of it. You know, is this metaphysical, spiritual man who talks about divine ascendancy and all kinds of interesting things and you know, is waving his Glock 19 around. Well, it's really, when we say, one way I like to think about it is when you're armed, you're not just armed with a piece of metal in your hands. You're armed with a piece of independent thought. And in their terms, that is symbolized in a weapon. Now, that's going to change because it's quite a crude way of symbolizing it, to be honest. And although we might enjoy shooting and targets and hunting, that's a personal choice. To kill people with weapons is a very crude way of behaving. There's no question about that. But that's their symbol. And when we engage with that, we have to take hold of that for a moment because it's a tool, it's an instrument, basically. And a lot of people who were with me on this, who were very, very pro-gun and pro-Second Amendment, do not own guns and not interested in shooting guns. They don't really want to hold a gun, right? I have no such problems personally. I rather like them, but that's a personal issue. I want to emphasize to people that the ability for the populace, a well-regulated militia necessary to the security of a free state, is very, very, very relevant, particularly in this timely manner at the moment. And you and I know, have been watching independent-minded, true-hearted human beings, forget Americans or patriots, we're not on about that, human beings who happen to be sheriffs. One of them, I'm very glad to say, right here in Oregon, who said, I will not enforce something that compromises the Constitution. I will not enforce that. And they have intimated that if federal agents come and press that point, shall we say, they will stand firm. So not everybody who is with the authorities, in quotes, is one of the bad guys. So let's be careful about that.
That's
because
right.
Some of the sheriffs right here where I live in Oregon, are outstanding human beings.
Well, the same in Utah. There are 29 sheriffs. By the way, the sheriff is different than a policeman because the sheriff is elected by the people.
Yes.
There are 29 sheriffs in the state of Utah. There were lots of deputies underneath those, but 29 sheriff's departments. 28 of them have already signed agreements, statements, public statements, that they will not enforce any federal infringement upon the right to bear arms. 29.
It's a very powerful statement, that, and it's the principle behind that is the thing that matters, because nobody wants to be running around with guns in some sort of massive showdown and, you know, the control people have bought all these rounds of ammunition and stuff and there's FEMA camp. You know, that is not necessarily what is going to happen. You know, one of the biggest secrets and the biggest vulnerabilities of the old hierarchy, as I like to call them, who've been around for an awful long time and still kind of run the show a little bit. But one of their big vulnerabilities is that they don't know what's going to happen in the future. They are not as powerful as they'd want us to think.
Sure.
And so how this plays out, I promise you, is not predetermined. There are no sure things with this. And so there need be never a gun pulled, you know, a round fired, blood spilled, never with this. However, the Bill of Rights, that being, for Europeans who are listening, I think the first 10 amendments in particular is very, very important right now. And it's not the best thing. It's not a perfect document. It was written a long time ago. But I'll tell you what, there's nothing like it in the world that I've seen that actually has an effect in people's lives. Here, I have to remind Americans of this all the time. There is a lot more craziness and a lot more extremism. Dumb Americans are the dumbest people in the world. Smart Americans are the smartest people in the world sometimes. That level of dynamism is directly down to a refusal to do it the European way. So although it's not perfect, and there's some crazy stuff that happens in this country, I'll tell you, some really crazy stuff. At the end of the day, when I go back home, when I go to Europe, and I've traveled extensively all over Eastern Europe, Russia, you know, Leningrad, as it's St. Petersburg, as it is now, all over these different places, there's nothing like this. There's nothing like this. And so I've said before, it does take an outsider, someone like me, to come in and remind you guys how priceless that Constitution is. It truly is a very, very wonderful thing. And it's not to say it can't be evolved, and it's not to say there aren't some strange forces that originally formulated. I'm well aware of that. The original formulation of it with Masonic influence and so on, I'm well aware of that. However, it makes it difficult to control this place because that's enshrined in letters, and because, another funny thing, the place is so big. So you have these localized authorities that are still governing themselves independently. So considering Texas virtually as a separate country is quite funny and is quite heartening to me. So although, again, you see some craziness in Texas and some extreme conservatism and traditionalism that does not benefit the human journey, you also see extreme freedom and extreme liberty in the face of any nonsense that Joe Biden can dream up or Barack Obama. And that doesn't happen in England. I promise you, that does not happen. You don't see that. And where those voices are speaking, because they're there, they're not on the television and the radio. You don't hear them because it's been snuffed out. People have become so acclimatized to oppression that they accept it. And that's the thing. It's the perception of this is very important. So we have to be careful that when the media, and even sometimes the people around us who we love, put pressure on us to just shut up, we have to not just take that at surface level, at face value. We have to do something about that and say, well, this preservation has to be kept alive. And we need scientists and philosophers and academics and engineers and poets and all different kinds of views on that. But we can't just let it go, because if we do, then it only takes a few little more events like this with a, you know, small nuclear device or something, and all the landscape changes really quickly. So we can't let that happen, and it's completely within our power to stop that.
Sure, sure it is. Because, you know, what we have here is we have a stage slowly, or shall we say a garden, slowly being planted by, you know, one thing and then another until the preponderance of evidence gets to the point where they can set a precedent and make a move. Generally speaking, between England and the U.S., we have some differences in the way our government is formed. In England, there is a ruler. You have the Queen, or you have the royal family.
The monarch, yes.
Yeah, the monarch. In the United States, there was never supposed to be a ruler. The way the government was set up, it was set up to govern. It was set up to allow states to trade amongst each other, to have one currency, to have a driver's license obtained in Oregon, be usable to rent a car in Florida. That's what the federal government was set up to be. It was set up to govern. It was set up to manage. But it has now become, at least in the last couple of presidencies, a rulership where the executive branch is commanding an army of secretaries with newly created administrations and bureaus and departments, and they have sweeping powers – like the National Defense Authorization Act, like various things that allow them to openly violate the first 10 amendments of the Constitution, and without recourse, without due process, without habeas corpus, without reading Miranda rights. I mean, these things are being thrown around like they mean nothing. And when the founders wrote these documents and then argued over them for a couple of decades before they became the law of the land, they knew that if one man became very powerful, that this is exactly how it turned out. And they knew that the richer and more powerful the nation became, the more industrious, the more diverse we became in our society, the more incredibly poignant and perfect this document would be in controlling or preventing that from happening. But what has happened is that the lust of men for power has become so great that this document is nothing more than a floor mat. When I hear in the halls of Congress, and I'm not talking to pages, I'm not talking to reporters or analysts, I'm talking to a sitting senator and not a freshman who says that we don't need states' rights anymore because we have a strong central government, that states' rights are an outdated concept that were only put in place by the founding fathers because we had a weak central government. That is so far off.
I wondered what you were going to say then, Brooks. That is so... Yeah. Carry on. I'm sorry.
Exactly. The question is, like a monarchy, when we have a good leader, someone who cares about, a more libertarian point of view, like, let's say, Governor Perry. Now, on the one hand, he's very conservative. But on the other hand, he allows immigrants to have in-state status when they're going to college, because he realizes that educated Mexicans are much better to have in the state of Texas and much better to have in Mexico than someone who is uneducated, who has been rejected from the system, who has not provided health care, not provided education. Of course an educated Mexican is a better asset to have on both sides of the border. His thinking is correct, but it is also not conservative, because he's not managing the state of Texas. He's leading it. That's a big difference.
It is a big difference, and it's funny. He's a great example of one of the paradoxical issues with Republican politics being largely responsible for leading the preservation of the Constitution, because he's kind of like stupid and very old-fashioned, but he's kind of like brave, and he's got a big heart as well. He rather reminds me of a sort of more formal, suited version of Ted Nugent, really, in that if you listen to Ted Nugent talk, I mean, I love Ted Nugent because of his music. You know, Stranglehold is like one of the best rock songs ever recorded, and he's an outstanding guitarist. I had no idea he was into politics and, you know, all the rest of it. I had no idea about that until recent times. And if you listen to Ted Nugent speak, he's very polarizing, he's very divisive, and yet you can't ignore some of the things he's saying, because I've heard him speak about certain subjects and say, look, I'm a free man. You know, I parachute into this world. Nobody has the right to tell me what to do, what to eat, what I can have, what I can't have. You know, it's my conduct that determines who I am. And my own personal morality and ethics and principles are based on my spirit, my family, my community, my love of my fellow man. And if you just took the guy's name off and you couldn't see anything, it could have been any spiritual person with that message saying exactly the same thing. So once more, I think it's unwise for us to label something as liberal or Republican and say, oh, we're sick of the liberals, oh, we're sick of the Republicans. I don't think that's helpful. So a lot of right-wing talk show hosts are just making things worse, really. Sure. I think it's got to be depoliticized, this, if we're to get anywhere, because we need conservatism and traditional values. We need liberalism and revolution. We need all those things together.
Well, it works if it acts like a republic. If you have individuals in Portland, you know, bringing their point of view to Washington, and you have individuals in Texas bringing their point of view to Washington, then you have a republic, and we debate things out. Sometimes we get things done, and sometimes we don't. Frankly, I like it better when government doesn't get anything done. But you know, that's just me. I think when they're not passing laws, we can actually catch up to the last set of regulations that were passed and begin to live within them if they just be consistent with it. But my point is that we have strayed away from being a republic. And it doesn't take a scientist and a great observer to see that. Anyone with, you know, the casual observation can see that we have strayed away from that. And we're getting dangerously close to what you described about a half hour ago. Mm-hmm. What happened when nationalism became whipped up into a single ideology complete with a theme song and someone to hate? And yeah. It didn't take long. It did not take long for the people to approve, vote in, and suit up.
Yeah, because people get into the frame of mind where they say, look, we've got to do something. And all you need is a very, very charismatic figure who says, look, I know you're sick of these people and you're sick of this problem and the economy's broken and our pride has been hurt. Let me restore those things. And all you need is the right figure to do that. And if I was an actor, I could play that figure because I know what that is. But it is a dishonorable thing and it is an inhuman thing and it isn't true. So we have to be careful on one hand, and we have to be very brave and show great fortitude and courage on the other hand, in that in these times they are going to try to make dissenting voices illegal, not just in terms of radical terrorists and fundamentalists and whatnot, but even in views like ours, they try to label them as, you know, unpatriotic and not helping and stirring up trouble. So the idea of extremism, just always remove that word whenever you read it in a newspaper or on a website. Remove the word extremism when you read it in the corporate media, and it takes the sting out of it. So yeah, one has to be very vigilant about the language and of how this stuff is used, because they load the sentences, the paragraphs, every single sentence is constructed to certain journalistic engineering ideals to put across a preloaded message. They don't want you to think about it. They want you to just swallow it down. So, you know, one gets in the habit when dealing with that of doing the reverse. You know, I like to throw in some positive propaganda. So I never say the media. I always say the corporate media. I never say capitalism. I say gangster capitalism when I'm referring to them. And that's just to draw people's attention to the fact that how you describe a thing formulates somebody else's thought about it if they're not confident enough to think for themselves. So yeah. If I talk to a person who lacks confidence and self-determination and I always say gangster capitalism, I can turn them away from that idea of capitalism being useful just by one little vocal pattern that I throw into my verbal delivery. And so we have to be careful that when we read something in the New York Times, in the Washington Post, in the Guardian, in the Telegraph, in the Times, whatever, to disinfect that language, to inoculate ourselves against it and look what's actually being said. And 9 times out of 10, when you do that, there's 5 pages of reports on the Boston Marathon bombing, and when you take out the hype and the programming, it'll say somebody set some bombs off and some people died, period. That's the end. That's all they're saying. That is all they are saying. The rest of it is commentary and is propaganda, and it's absolutely no different now than it was at any time prior to or immediately after a war, where propaganda is very important to lead people into it and very important to lead people out of it. And we're being led into a new kind of conflict with this.
Because we're being divided. And if you're a student of history and you go back and read, you know, the results of the publication of Mein Kampf, my struggle, and the rise of that kind of mindset where here we are picking crumbs with the sparrows, and there they are eating off fine china and taking steamships wherever they want to in the world and wearing furs and observing fine art in their private galleries of their homes. And we call them today, we call them millionaires and billionaires. But it might as well come out of the same kind of mindset. There's the enemy over there with the gold chain on. Let's get him.
Yeah, absolutely.
Are you not hearing that right now from not just politicians, but also what you call the gangster media? It's exactly what you're hearing.
The corporate media are essentially, as has been tracked for a long time, essentially the media stopped being the media, i.e. just an unbiased, unprejudiced, fair body of people reporting news. That stopped happening around about the late 90s, early 2000s, because of corporate sequestration of those things. That stopped then. So for the last decade, we have had no media. It doesn't exist anymore. And that is a fact. And you can look into that, and you can read about that in my book, and you can read about that on the internet. And I can document how that's happened and how that's come about. And all you have to do is look at news reports from England from the 1970s and 80s, compare them with news reports from England today, and the news now is like children's news. It's news for muddleheads. It's news for people with no time. It's news for people with no concentration, no sort of ability to focus in on anything. And that's all there is now. There isn't anything else. And I picked up some newspapers just a few days ago, sat waiting for someone. I thought, oh, here we go. Here's the considered, reasoned, posh American newspapers. Let me have a flick through them and see what they're saying these days. And goodness me, to put it bluntly, to put it mildly, should I say, what a load of rubbish. What a load of piffle. Not just what they were saying and the points they were making, but actually the literacy and the sentence construction and the intellect was just awful. It was just shockingly bad. And that's what's passing for news. And again, I'm not singling out Britain and America. It's just those are the places I'm most familiar with. It's the same anywhere. It's the same in France and Italy and, you know, Mumbai and, you know, Indonesia, wherever. You know, it's the same thing. So we have to be disciplined in the sense that if we have the inkling that people like you and I and our colleagues in the field are one of the only other alternatives at the moment, then we have to be very, very sharp in what we do and very, very solid in substantiating the things that we're putting forward to the level that if we were instituting a college for this, you know, most applicants to come and join our college would be turned away because they're not good enough. This is a very sensitive time where people who do come and look at the information that's out there and do want to do things differently have to be sort of taken into account, really. So we have to understand that, and we have to understand that, you know, there's an awful lot of people out there who want to do something differently and who want to do things in a more truthful sort of human way. And we have to make sure that as they grow, and as that sort of light comes on in people's head, when they look around and get ready to sort of flex their spiritual muscles and their intellects and their self-determination, we need to make sure that there is a massive fellowship, right, of powerful, honorable human beings that will welcome them, support them, educate them, collaborate together, share and learn and grow with them,
and be
a sort of brilliant alliance of true humanity. That's how we change it.
There is.
All we need to do is get together.
There's a great community ready to receive those people. And that's really what I want to get across in the final hour tonight. You know, the last time you were on the program, you said, if you can do Earth as a human being, you can do anything.
That's right.
One of the things that we have to realize, Earth Explorers, is you're not going to get out of this alive. I don't care what you do. And you're not going to be able to take a single one of those toys with you. That there is a profound reason why you are alive on the earth at this time. That the earth is in a very peculiar position, not just in space. We all know that. But I mean with respect to the population, our ability to communicate, our ability to diversify, our daily needs for our daily bread, almost all the way around the world. I mean, we diversify our food production. We diversify our clothing production. We have an unbelievable choice of things upon which we can spend our time. Sports, art, literacy, mechanics, engineering, painting, love, dancing, music, anything you want. And you can spend a lifetime on it and not learn it all. That's for a reason. You're here on this planet at this time as part of this global consciousness we call humanity for a reason. And it isn't to pile up the largest possible 401k you can and pass it on to your kids. There's another purpose to it. And I want to talk about that purpose because we've talked about great forces, some evil, some good, that are trying to distract us. In fact, they're trying to elicit our support. They're trying to align us with them, to label us or to put a uniform on us, whether we wear it or not, so that we fall in line with the 47% or the 51% or the 99%. You're being classified like cattle in a chute, and you're being counted among an army about which you have no awareness. And that's what I want to talk about when we come back, if you'll stay with me, Neil.
Yes.
All right, let's take a quick break. We'll listen to something a little more modern. Let's see. How about we'll do some Imagine Dragons? We'll be back in about 5 minutes. Don't go away.
To the top. Don't hold back.
Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. We are so glad you have been with us for the past 2 hours. My guest tonight is Neil Kramer, philosopher and author of the book The Unfoldment. Neil, why don't you tell them how they can get the book?
Sure. Well, you can go along to Barnes & Noble and Amazon.com and all those wonderful places, and you can get it from there. You can get it from most major physical bookstores. You can read about it on my website and get some links from there. But it really doesn't matter to me. I'm just glad to share information and for people to read it and enjoy it. And that book, The Unfoldment, it really is my attempt to create in one book an opportunity where you can give that book to someone and say, look, if you're interested in the world and you're kind of a bit disgruntled and a bit fed up, but you want to do something, you want to make a change and you don't know where to begin, here's one interesting crossroads to stand at, which will give you some good signposts for your other options. And it will give you a fair balance of how dark and weird things are, but also how excellent and powerful we are and what an adventure this is. And it's a very approachable book. So that was my project. That was my experiment with this book. And the next one will be more to people who, are ready to go into more esoteric knowledge, which hopefully we can talk a little bit about now. But that book really does speak to a lot of people who right now are going to be thinking, well, what do we do? Where do we begin? There's so many avenues to explore metaphysically and to look at consciousness and look at the relationship between ourselves and the world. Where do we begin? So people like ourselves and many of the listeners, we've all got our journey with that and we've all been doing this for a long time. But you know that there's a lot of people out there who are on the brink of it and want to do something but aren't sure entirely where to start. And maybe it's not right for them to go on a sort of, you know, week-long Vipassana meditation right now, or to dive into, you know, esoteric mysticism. You know, they might not want to do that. So you have to approach somebody respectfully and not patronize them and take all that into account, which is what The Unfoldment is all about. That.
Yeah, that there is, you know, in every tradition, and forgive me if I, you know, don't call them religions, for every tradition, there is a sort of teleology, that is to say, a study of a pattern or a formula that God has set forth for each individual. For Christians, it's one thing. For Muslims, it's another. For Buddhists, it's another. And generally speaking, this kind of either removes your individual freedom or it absolves you of any responsibility for your own position.
That's the key thing there, right there, Brooks. That's the key one for me.
Yeah, it absolves you of any individual presence in the system. So if you're a jihadist and you go apply your jihadist teleology, thinking that you're on some kind of path that your leaders have indoctrinated you into believing, you've absolved yourself of any ramifications of the violence you perpetrate on any innocents. And that's kind of what we want to talk about, is that, yes, there's a formula, but the formula only creates the possibilities. And as you know, in physics, we're all about possibilities. We play with them in mathematics by adding one thing to both sides of an equation to try to cancel out all of the terms that we don't want to consider in this particular treatment of the formula until we come up with at least a relationship like E is equal to mc squared that we understand. And it's that way in real life too. We eliminate those things that we can't do anything about, or we accept those things we can't do anything about, until we get down to the smallest number of things we can do something about, like go to work every day, earn a paycheck every Friday, take a vacation every summer, you know, get married, have kids, or not get married, don't have kids, be gay, I don't, you know, whatever the smallest number of possibilities that you can consider for yourself, and in that you trick yourself into being happy. And what you don't realize, or what you have forgotten, is that you are an eternal being having a mortal experience, and that your possibilities are absolutely unlimited. And it doesn't matter if you're 8, 18, or 80. you can start immediately considering those possibilities.
Yes, you can. And I think that that's one of the curious things about some of the more conspiratorial things that we consider, is that, as I noted about 7 or 8 years ago, a lot of conspiracy people get stuck in conspiracy research and geopolitics and parapolitics and whatnot. They get caught there. They get caught in the brambles, and it snags their coat, and they can't move, and they just think, oh, well, you know, maybe I'll stay here for a while. And the answers aren't there. And so some of the more prominent, popular people who speak on conspiracy matters, a little bit, without naming names, go around in circles a bit, because they're missing some of the other elements of that, and they're not giving you sufficient scope for you to go away and think about it. So although people are getting to the idea that consciousness and spirit are really important, they're not properly applying that in terms of the history of what's going on here. And I was having this conversation with somebody recently, and you know, a major part of my work is the mystical principles, the metaphysical principles, if you don't like the word mysticism, from the ancient world, from the ancient earth world, and how they are still very central to modern life, but are now largely hidden. So that those mystical principles of magic and manifestation and creation and destruction, they're not part of the mainstream dialogue anymore. They're entirely separated out from consensus reality. So let me get a bit esoteric here with you for a moment, if you would indulge me, Brooks.
I love esotericism. Go ahead.
Okay. Let's talk about the ritual magic element of what's been going on at the Boston Marathon for a moment, because I see some value in considering the question of psychological operations, psyops, from a metaphysical angle, not just the practicalities and the tactical things, as well as the psychological effects we talked about earlier, propagated through the media and so on. There is also a further more mystical law being exercised with the Boston Marathon, right? One that requires blood to be spilled, okay?
Mm, right.
And in other words, it is a sacrifice, a ritual sacrifice. And sacrifice is something that was taken and co-opted from the ancients, and it was distorted and changed into something else. They didn't approach it how we have these images of these savages in beads with blades cutting virgins' throats. It wasn't like that at all. The whole thing was modified to serve the negative emanations of this world. And now its sacrifice is indeed very much a dark piece of magic. So let's take an example, right? And to approach this in the right manner, I just need to set the scene here for a second. So let me propose a scenario for you to think about, okay? So let's imagine for a moment that we're going to conduct a piece of serious reality engineering, right? We're going to intervene in the usual regulated flow of consensus reality, and we are going to make something very particular happen in accordance with our will. We are going to create a specific kind of situation and manifest it into the construct, right? And we're going to achieve this by creating an analog, a template, right? A piece of ritual theater that will simulate the real thing that we actually want to manifest. And let us say that in our magical operation to do this, there are three elements, right? Three buildings, in fact. So picture this. Building A, right, is a building in which a simulation of a live shooting is taking place, right? A live shooter training drill simulating the sort of calamity of a rogue shooter killing innocent people, with all the planning and drama and guns and screaming kids and hiding and grief that entails. So that's building A, a training exercise. Building B is a secret building, let's say, in which an experienced magical practitioner is harnessing certain powers, certain forms of essentially electromagnetic radiation that science is a bit sketchy on at the moment, and he is harnessing these potent fourth density forces based on the situation, the simulation that is occurring in Building A. He is harvesting and focusing the sort of fountain of human consciousness, the energies of violence and fear, and the huge emotional outpouring. He is taking those real forces and transferring them into the outside world, outside of the simulation and into the real. So finally, right, finally we have Building C, in which the events of Building A begin to transpire in reality. People kill people for real. And it could be that Building C is totally unconnected with Building A. The real one is unconnected with the simulation. They may have nothing to do with each other at all. Or it could be that Building C is pre-selected. Both are possible. So do you see the dynamic there? Do you see the magical principle there? Do you get the magical orchestration from within Building B? That's where the sorcery takes place. That's what makes the connection. That changes the reality. So there's this kind of micro theater simulation being played out in Building A, and they're taking that pattern, charging it with real emotions and manifesting it apparently spontaneously and randomly into another location nearby. No strings, no evidential trail, no logic to it, and it's beyond the mind of the mainstream man. And this is a very old, traditional magical operation. And I see that there's a connection there with Boston.
Sure. But it's a broad analog, because in Building A, you have this spiritual creation where you have at least imagined or at least pictured some relationship or some concepts. And then in Building B, you physically create that by putting energy behind it and manifesting it, investing in it, putting the pieces in place so the possibility becomes much more imminent. And in Building C, you actually have the occurrence.
That's right.
Take place. But, you know, what we need to do as a society, as individuals, is to realize that we have abdicated our responsibility in Building B to someone else.
Well, that's right. And that, for me, that 4D sorcery aspect of this, as I say, has equal importance to the 3D sort of tactical aspect. And, you know, we can't fully comprehend it. Most people think it's fantasy, that sort of thing. But if you only play private investigator and conspiracy researcher, as the media would have it, you will come to a dead end. You will ultimately draw a blank. And equally, if you just think about the philosophy of it, you'll also draw a blank. What we have to do is both. We have to educate ourselves to be philosophers and scientists and mystics and tacticians if we have to have any real sort of penetrating perceptions here. And if you want, just by the way, the satisfaction, this is quite important in a way, if you want the satisfaction of having to think that there's some sort of karmic payback for the negative magic and the negative sorcerers involved in this, let me tell you, the universe never allows anyone to get away sort of scot-free from such things. It might appear that they do. They might walk away laughing and rubbing their hands and, you know, going undetected by human authorities. But on another level, there is an indebtedness that will not go away until it is paid in full with interest. So they know that. And there are sometimes even, and this is very odd, but attempts to take another human soul and try and offload the karma onto that soul. And this in certain areas is called the law of restorative harmonics, and they put it onto them. But such things, you know, whilst they appear to have an immediate effect, they don't really. It just makes matters worse. So negative magical rituals cannot be sprayed liberally around. You know, it has to be very specific, very concentrated, and very carefully calculated. You can't really, you know, just do it willy-nilly. And you cannot also, and this comes back to what you just said, Brooks, you can't do it to someone without their free will. So it's much easier to get away with stuff by garnering unconscious support for this collective destruction. So ask people if it's okay to kill each other legally, as we have agreed to do so in Britain and Europe and America, and then go ahead and do it. So ask people is it okay to throw away the constitutions and the principles and our abiding guidelines of natural human law and instead just accept a bunch of crooks running the show? Is that okay? And we've said, yes, it is okay.
Yeah, we did. We did. We allowed the federal government to conscribe our state militias, stick an extra patch on their shoulder, put them in an airplane, send them to a foreign country and tell them to kill instead of helping Americans during times of tornadoes and floods and hurricanes and fires and earthquakes, which is what the National Guard has traditionally done for 375 years. And the individuals that signed up for the Weekend Warrior program, 2 weekends a month and 2 weeks in the summertime, ended up serving full-time as warriors, not what they signed up to be. And instead of bullets or tanks or gas or exposure getting them, suicide got them.
Yeah, that's very true. And that was a very startling statistic that has been brought out in recent times, isn't it? That more people are offing themselves, if I can put it bluntly like that, than are being killed in actual live theatre conflict.
When you pick up a weapon and you shoot tin cans or you shoot an animal or you shoot paper targets, it's one thing. When you just point that weapon at another human being, regardless of whether you pull the trigger or not, your life is changed forever. Now, I used to play with weapons just like Neil does now, but I had a close call with the weapon when I was about halfway through with this mortal life. Not an accident, just a close call. And I have not touched a weapon since, because just that millisecond changed my life forever. I will never handle another weapon. It's not for me.
Do you know what, Brooks? Let me tell you something on that. When I speak about weapons and guns and stuff, I do so philosophically and politically if necessary, but also because this is the kind of person that I have decided to be, I actually want to know as well. So I want to know what it feels like to shoot and kill and do this and that, not necessarily other human beings. That could lead to all kinds of problems. But I, in recent times, have been on a safety course, a firearms safety course, which was really an introduction to it, conducted by the local sheriff's department here, so you can't get more institutionally focused than that. And the course, 50 people in the audience, I was one of them, was conducted by a local law enforcement dude who was an excellent person. And they kind of said that, you know, they went through what these things are, what the laws are, what we can do, what we can't do, what they're for and that. And so it was an opportunity to really get that experience from a law enforcement point of view. You understand that was what I was particularly interested in. How do they portray it? And they, in their own ranks, the guy was telling us that there is a very clear difference between a police officer who has killed a person and a police officer who has not killed a person. And he says, from that moment onwards, your whole life becomes different. And if you've had a serious injury, that factors into it. Or if you've had a close call, indeed, as you say, Brooks, that is a very similar thing. And he said, however many times you've seen simulations or movies or you've heard stories, he said, there's nothing like it. He said, as soon as you extinguish life, you extinguish a part of your own life. And I thought that was a very, very potent comment from basically, you know, a guy who walks around in a police uniform around our streets or whatever. Very, very wise words there, because some of the people were very new to this whole realm and some were very experienced. You know, there were some old timers there as well who knew all about this stuff, but were re-educating themselves on certain elements of it. But to hear that is very important, I think, because it does change the game when you actually start to play with the creation or the destruction of life.
It does. And even in the underworld, there is a term called getting made.
Yeah.
You're made when you extinguish a life in the name of the gang or the name of the army or the name of the military unit or the name of the operation. When you're made, then the leaders know they have you because you have relinquished that innocence. You've relinquished that clean hands that you brought into the group, and you've now become part of the blood of that group. And at that point, then, you will fight for each other, your brothers in arms, and you'll fight to the last man.
You do, because that creates an unusual bond, you know, typically between one man and another when you have, you know, killed together or you have saved each other from fire or whatever. That does create a very unusual and very intimate bond. Sometimes it's very affectionate and excellent and a deep fellowship between one man and another. But it can also be, you know, subverted, that, can't it? It can be taken from particularly gullible, impressionable young men in the army, and it can be used as a sort of a tool to sort of fragment the psyche and just program them to go out and do whatever they're damn well told.
Well, let's talk about that fragmentation just a little bit more. We have never had a president who has divided the country the way the country's divided right now. Now, we've had divisive presidents in the past. We've had events occur to this nation, maybe back in September 11th of 2001, when you couldn't find a little American flag to wave for love nor money in any store in the country because they were already bought by people who wanted to wave one. But now the nation is divided in a way that's never been divided before. The civilian population is buying guns and ammunition at an unprecedented
rate. Goodness me.
That is a fraction. That's a division that cannot be denied. And as a physicist, I have to say that the probability of an accident, of a really bad accident occurring, is going up exponentially every day that this fractionation happens.
Well, the irony of this situation has not escaped many newspaper people, many media people, who have said that since Obama started to try and control guns, gun sales have skyrocketed. Without, nothing has ever looked like this before. Nothing has ever looked like this before. If I, from December, right, till today, if I go into my local Walmart, which is an adventure in itself, to be honest, and I go to the, you know, outdoor section where there are fishing rods and knives and camping equipment, in America, as Americans will know, but Europeans may be surprised to know, you can also buy ammunition. You can buy your shotgun shells, your double-aught, you know, buckshot shells. You can buy your 9mm hollow point rounds. You can buy your 45 rounds, etc. And there they are. You hand them over. No ID required. You could be anyone, and they hand them over. Those shelves for months have been empty. There is no ammunition on the shelves. They're restocking them slowly, but it's unheard of. So the shelves are empty, which means the supply and demand situation has radically twisted in the last 6 months since Sandy Hook, because some people are afraid. Some people are angry. Some people are going into survival, you know, hibernation mode. But whatever, whichever way you look at it, it's an unusual occurrence that. And it's not just in the big stores, it's in the little ones as well. So the ammunition is not on the shelves anymore.
Well, you can also go to online sources and you can see the same thing happening. I've watched it. I felt the same temptation as everyone else. I've gone to, you know, online gun stores and looked at the price of weapons the last year. Mm-hmm. They've not quite doubled, but they've probably gone up 30 or 40%, which is really unbelievable in 1 year. Just unbelievable. And I've read articles here and there where factories are running 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They can't make them fast enough. So while all of these agencies like the post office and the IRS and, I don't know, the National Weather Service is buying up billions of rounds of hollow point 40 caliber bullets, literally. I mean, 5 or 6 rounds for every man, woman, and child in the country. The civilians are doing exactly the same thing. And I can tell you, just like kids playing after midnight, nothing good will come of this.
Yeah, it's something that is not exactly the best way to do things, and it's not exactly something to be cheering about. Whatever your view is of it, it's like an overreaction. And I've seen this with gold, and silver. You know, those prices have bounced down again recently, which is quite unusual. And we're seeing, you know, what's his name, Paulson and Soros, and they're dumping stocks and all, left, right, and center. So there's always moves afoot. And I'll be totally honest with you. When I first started tracking some of the fiscal patterns, which is, you know, sounds a rather unexciting thing to do, but when you watching the movement of a nation, you have to watch the movement of its economy, or you miss things. And when I started tracking the economy, particularly in the US, in about 2005, it did feel like any moment it was going to all collapse, any moment. And some very influential, serious thinkers and movers and shakers who have walked down the corridors of power, as you might think, agreed with me and said, yeah, any time now, any time now. And it feels like that again. But 2006, 7, 8, 9, 10, 2011, 2012, 2000, and we're still here teetering on the edge all the time. So I fully expected there to be a major crash or a major correction, is some of the language that people use, isn't it? And it hasn't happened yet. So, you know, do you see that on the way, Brooks? You've been here longer than I have.
You know, there are some big forces at work here. First of all, you have Japan trying to save its economy, finally, by printing currency. They also need to generate value. So they've rumored that they're going to start selling their gold off. They haven't actually started doing it, but they rumored that they're going to start doing it. And what that did to the price of gold is it plunged it to about $1,400 an ounce. People or organizations like Bloomberg and Reuters are using the word panic in their publication. But mind you, the gold really hasn't started moving yet. It hasn't actually started selling yet because the Japanese have no intention of selling their gold. What they want to do is buy gold, cheap gold. Now, let's flash back just a few weeks to, I think it was about 4 weeks ago, right here on this program, we said that tomorrow, which was 4 weeks ago, the Cyprus bank is going to be closed by the IMF and they're going to seize the depositors' money or a percentage of it to try to bail out the bank, not with taxpayers' money, but with depositors' money. And if that doesn't cover the bill, they're going to start selling their gold off. And that's exactly what they did.
That is exactly what they did, yeah.
Now that gold is going on the market, there are three countries that are buying it up as fast as they can get it. Russia, Japan, and no, unfortunately not the United States, but the Fed. They're buying it up with printed money. And so Cyprus's gold is about consumed, and Japan has been not selling off its gold, but bulking up its gold. So, gee, who really made money? Well, the ones that made money were the ones that were carrying naked short contracts on that gold. Same thing with silver. 300,000 short contracts managed by J.P. Morgan Stanley have now paid off. All those people have made their billions off of the silver. And now, of course, J.P. Morgan Stanley is the largest depository of silver in the world. Now the price is going to go back up, and they'll make money on the long position of silver. That's just the way it goes. Now, is a crash going to occur? Are we going to move away from the dollar? The answer is yes. Several nations, several major nations are moving away from the dollar. But a lot of people don't realize that one of the main reasons that the Iraq war was fought is because the Iraqi dinar was not going to be based on the dollar. It was going to be based on another currency. We could not allow it, so we went to war. And the Iraqi dinar fell off of the market. Yeah. Well, now there are something like, I don't know, 7 trillion Iraqi dinars out there in private and governmental possession. Lots of investors bought them through banks and through online sellers, but the federal government owns about 4 trillion Iraqi dinar. If the Iraqi dinar revaluates, and rumors have it that it's going to happen this month, it will happen at high levels first, somewhere between $3 and $5 per dinar. When that happens, a vital currency, not backed by gold, backed by oil, even better than gold, because it's much more plentiful, much more valuable right now, because we could use it.
Yeah.
is going to be based on the dollar. And that is probably going to save the American economy. And it probably will mean that the American dollar will not collapse.
Well,
that's all about.
Yeah, thank you. That's fascinating. That's really interesting. I mean, we'll steer it back into some of the esoteric things. It's so important to be able to have a good hand with this, to be able to say, you need to know what's going on with economics. If you don't, you miss the trajectory of the energy itself. So although it's not about money and it's not about oil, those in themselves are abstractions from the real energy. Those give an incredibly good idea of how things are changing. And I spoke to one individual who I won't name, but who, again, is a credible tracker of these things for many years. And he sort of looked me in the eye recently and said, the US dollar is not going to crash. They tried to do it a few years ago, and it's not going to happen now. So it's just such a sort of roller coaster. This it's just funny because I know that there's some people with lots of money, very lucky people who are like, you know, desperate to know what's going to happen. And then amusingly, I know many more people who don't have any money, and they're also desperate to know what's going to happen. So it's like it's a very funny thing because at the end of the day, that system can't really afford to throw everything down the toilet, as it were, because the whole propagation and distribution of this low resonance consciousness, which really is what the game's about at the end of the day, that starts to be negatively affected if you mess up the transaction method, i.e. the commercial purpose behind most people's lives. If you mess that up, then they've got a big problem. So it's not them who want to mess that up. It's us who want to mess that up by replacing it with something different. Do you know what I mean?
Well, yeah, but at the end of the day, it isn't about the wealth. It's about the power.
No, indeed. That's right, yeah.
And
go ahead, sorry.
Our phone lines are open. So if you want to call in anywhere in North America, if you have some thoughts on this, or observations, 888-429-5471. Questions for Neil or myself, 888-429-5471. And we're also taking calls from outside the country on 530-413-9537. 530-413-9537.
And just in case we get a call, I just wanted to cover one more thing briefly related to the Boston Marathon event. I made a little note on a post-it note here, and I forgot to mention it. So it's a bit disjointed, this, from the original part of the conversation. But back to the sort of esoteric angle of that, we talked about some of the sorcery of using analogues and creating a pattern and then making that go out into the real world. Well, another thing that's special about that particular date, April the 15th, is that it's unusual in, if you look at sort of Golden Dawn and Rosicrucian inspired, you know, Egyptian numerological correspondences, 105 is a very important number, and April the 15th is the 105th day of the year. So when a magical exercise is conducted, they don't do it just on any day. They choose the day very carefully. And 105, in their magical traditions, to the best of my knowledge, is associated with subversion, ruin, and change, right? Now, as I said before, you can't fully comprehend what's happening here until you know both situations in this play. So we have to just consider this information, whether you think it's relevant or not is something to decide later, but we have to consider it. April the 15th is also the festival of Baast or Ubast, the Egyptian cat goddess. And this deity has been consistently worshipped since around 3000 BC, 5000 years ago. And the cult of Baast was centered in a place in the Delta region along the Nile. You might have even been near it. A place called Bubastis. Sounds a bit like Boston to me. And there were wonderful stone statues of this goddess. the Eye of Ra, the Lady of the Flame, as she was known. Originally, she was lion-headed and solar, and then later became depicted as cat-headed and lunar of mm-hmm. the moon. And the stone that we have today, alabaster, is named after this deity. But she was considered as, and this is the key bit, the defender of the pharaoh. That is, the defender of the empire. And so the festival of Ba'ast is to defend the empire. And every year in times gone by, on festival day, thousands of people would gather. There would be music, song, dance, and sacrifice. And Ba'ast was central to this, and blood would need to be spilled to be given to this goddess. And so anyone who has done their esoteric homework, we all know that Egypt is incredibly important to understanding the hidden political maneuverings here. It's not just some old-fashioned, weird stuff. It's absolutely vital that you understand Egypt and the last few thousand years of it. And in this sense, it is not such a stretch to say that the blood spilled at the Boston Marathon was a sacrifice to Ba'ast in this magical sense.
I couldn't resist when you mentioned the defense of the empire. That's kind of what we're facing right here. We're facing the defense of the empire. You know, we have our own theme song. We have our own good versus evil. We have our star-spangled national way of doing things, the things that pull at the heartstrings, that inspire people. We do it at all our sporting events. We do it at everything that's important. We bring everybody together and focus everybody on what? On the enemy. And we give them a new hope.
Very good, very good. You must have a vast library of sounds at your fingertips there, Brooks. Honestly, how the hell did you get that so quick? And I'll throw this one in as a little, this is more of an esoteric curiosity, quite frankly. It was also the day at the Boston Marathon that 101 years ago the Titanic sank. So there's a little point of interest. It was also the day, somebody told me yesterday, that Dodi al-Fayed, an Egyptian, a royal in many ways, was assassinated with his royal girlfriend, the blue blood Princess Diana, in 1997. And so depending on how seriously you look at this, you have to take all factors into account. And as one of my heroes, Sherlock Holmes, although he is fictional, but based on a real guy, although Holmes was meticulous about details, he said, when you're investigating the essence of a thing, you have to take into account all the details that seem utterly trivial, all of them. And some of them you may indeed drop and say, actually, that's not relevant, let's get rid of it. But put all of them in at first, put all of them into that crucible. And then when you bring your flame to it, your fire of thought, your gift of divine reason, your lucidity, then the things that are untrue will burn away and will disappear. And what's left will be the truth. So we should never be afraid to throw in, you know, seemingly unconnected things or things that are distant. So knowing a lot about pagan philosophy and pagan spirituality from Britain, April the 15th is also the beginning of the Willow Moon, which is a celebration of the willow tree, which is a very important magical plant. And it is a tree that is, its power is associated with enchantment. And the media, the corporate media, if they aren't doing an enchantment job on the minds of the people, then I don't know who is.
Well, yeah, in fact, I have a listener out in Arizona that just mentioned this is the first public sacrifice to have 21st century media coverage.
Right. So I think it's viable, and I think it's appropriate that sometimes we consider this as enchantment, as not in the kind of glorious, lovely, radiant way, but as a negative spell, enchanting somebody against their will to do something that is in dishonor. And I think it's absolutely appropriate to see the sorcery behind that. And if anybody doubts it, you know, go back in the history books, go to Greece, go to Rome, and look for patterns that are just like this, where not only were the events orchestrated, which is, you know, what where most people stop, right? The government orchestrated it. That's the end for us. But the question in everybody's minds is why? Why do they do these things? Why do they do these things? And my answer to that, the simple answer, which you then have to go away and unravel in your own time, is because low resonance human consciousness is a very good resource for beings trapped in negative dimensions.
Right.
Very, very, very important.
Yeah, builds armies very quickly.
And it does. And so the theater, although we have to take account of it and we have to understand it, the real lives, you know, real heroes on the streets in Boston, real people dead now, you know, they're real families with real emotions and real lives. There is nevertheless an orchestration of that energy at a level that many people do not take into account. And so if you do have a mystical awareness or mystical training or mystical initiation, which I do have all those things, then it becomes part of my self-appointed obligation, my duty, to say, well, let me tell you something else about what might be happening here. And with that, you can then go away and do some of your own studies. You can go and have a look at that yourself. And you can, you know, not just with Google, but also with your own mind and your own intuition, your own connection to the universe, your own ability to gather with other people. And as you said before, where we originally met was at James Gilliland's ranch, which although it is associated with UFOs and paranormal activity, is also, and primarily for me, to be honest, it's just a place where people who are interested in the world, in the truth of reality, they come there to gather. They go to that place, amongst others, but that's one of them. They go to that place to have proper dialogue on this stuff and to really just put all the defenses aside for a minute, to not mess around debating, but just to converse on it, to have meaningful dialogue on it. And you know, Brooks, that there's an awful lot of that that goes on there, and that's its tremendous value to our lovely, you know, part of the world over here in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, it's one of the great meeting places on the planet. That's literally a sanctuary where you can go and meet Neil and myself and, you know, others that have been out exploring and have discovered things and have an idea about things, where we come and converse on those ideas. And I would say on a pretty regular basis, on an annual basis, we have solved all the world's problems year after year right there.
We do, because all we do is a very simple thing, which is we bring together a couple of hundred brilliant human beings, some of them from different parts of the world, some of them from around the corner, some of them from different walks of life, attorneys, scientists, professors, NASA people, plumbers, carpenters, electricians, cops, everything you can think of, people who have taken it upon themselves to go, wait a minute, I am going to seriously take account of my own inner landscape, my own serious life, and examine the relationship between that and the world outside, because that is something that I have been given the privilege and the gift to do, to witness and participate in this world. And we have these wonderful places around the planet, and this is one of them, where people come together. And yeah, there's guys who stand up on stage and give a presentation on a specific bit of information, and we'll talk about new science and new thought and paranormal things. Yeah, that's always relevant. There's always new things to look at. But the real juice is all the other bits of it, where people for a good 3 or 4 days will wander around and talk and contemplate and sit in the middle of the night, you know, smoking their cigars and drinking wine or sipping tea and gazing at the stars or whatever it is you're into, and sharing, making connections with people. And this is how we solve things. You bring those people together and stuff starts to happen. Projects start to formulate. Relationships begin to arise. People fall in love. You know, people become friends. New things start to happen. That alchemy takes care of itself. All you have to do is show up.
Well, that's it. And they do. And the last few years, it has, so many people have showed up, they've sold the place out. So
that's right.
We're going to have to expand the franchise to other places. And I think other places have tried it. I think Sedona and some other places around the country have tried it. But nothing's been as successful as Trout Lake in this particular way. It's not a particularly touristy place. If you don't mind staying in a tent for a week, it's quite the experience, at least in the people that you meet. And it just seems to be one of the power places on the earth. And
it
I don't
is,
think
it is.
A single person that's ever gone there that hasn't left saying, I have never seen anything like that before and I don't know how to explain it.
And how fascinating. I mean, you know, it's one weekend out of the year, and you know, it's really is time well spent. And frankly as well, financially, it's not prohibitive to get there and save up $200 or $300 or whatever it is. It's really money well spent, because, as I say, it's not just the phenomena of the place, the beauty of the place, and the meeting some of the speakers and whatnot. It's really about going to a place where there's another way of human existence. There's another way of doing things that is in the flesh right there. And you can walk around and talk to people about it. And there's people just like you. Some of them a bit shy and lonely. Some of them very gregarious. Some of them mad into all kinds of things. Others beginners, you know, whatever it is, wherever you're at. It's important that we do gather, and that's one place to do it. And increasingly in my work, and I do a lot of teaching work as well, you know, people can read about that on the website, but a lot of people say the important thing for me is to begin to develop a new set of, a new social network of real people with real meetings, where we actually physically sit together and we drink tea together, and we walk in the forest together, we walk through the city together, we do stuff, and we meet, and we can look in our calendars and know that there's going to be a consistent presence with that. So this sort of new community is really, really important, because just doing it always remotely, just a voice on the radio, just an image on a screen, is not enough. You have to do more than that, and that means connecting with people in your area. And it's always surprising to people how many other people there are who want this. They think there's just a few because maybe they don't know many in their community, but there's not. There's thousands, tens of thousands.
Well, this October, by the way, if you're into gregarious, shy and lonely inventor type people, we have the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference that's going to occur in Boulder, Colorado, another high place on the planet. We had the first one in Hilversum, Holland. I've never been there before, but I was so amazed at the quality of the people that run this organization. Just, I mean, you got Stephanie Paulus, you got several of the Dutch participants, Joran, other individuals that lead that organization, tremendous souls, tremendous leaders, sacrificing their time and their energy and in a lot of cases their money to make this event happen. So check it out. It's called the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference. We have a link to it at X Squared Radio, and we'll be talking more about that as the months come on. Huge, huge, if you're into breakthrough energy making its way to the mainstream, that would be you, the consumer. If you really want to see it firsthand, handle it, watch it work, get involved as an activist, as a letter writer, as an investor, this is the place to come. Well, I can't believe 3 hours has gone by this quickly. We've got about 5 minutes left. Neil's book is called The Unfoldment, and you can get it everywhere. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, everywhere where fine books are sold. And the recording, if you missed the live broadcast tonight, or you know friends that are going to miss it, we're going to put it in the free listening area, and I'm going to give Neil the link. Now, we'll put a link at X Squared Radio, too, but that way you can grab that link, email it out, Facebook it out, Twitter it out, and we'll get this tonight's broadcast in as many hands as possible, because this was a classic. This is a best of, to be sure. And I just want to extend my appreciation and my brotherhood to Neil for coming on the program tonight. It was short notice. It was driven by current events, and I'm so glad that Neil was able to rearrange his busy schedule to be.
I had to kick some poor dude out today, but he's a very understanding chap. So he was like, "Yeah, okay, we'll do it next week." So, yeah, no, it's been my pleasure, Brooks. It's been my pleasure as last time. It's always interesting. It's always important, and one gets the sense that if in any way we can make changes, if we can ask people to take themselves seriously, to share information with those who put the hand up and ask for it. Make it available to those who are curious so they can grab it for themselves and have a little secret listen if they're not sure. You know, that's all we can do, really. And further than that, as you say, we do these events through the year, and they can go to our websites and have a look at what we're doing and what we're about and what products we have. But the juice is doing the thing itself. The juice for me is the knowledge and the sharing itself. If we were in this for the money, I think we'd be doing something completely different, wouldn't we?
Absolutely. And in fact, I think if you're in it for the money, I kind of distrust that, right?
I know. Yeah, one is very cautious about that. But yeah, it's such an adventure. There are so many fascinating things to look at. And really, one of the rewards, one of the benefits of this kind of work, getting involved in it, and this is for everybody, anyone who gets involved in it in their own life, is that it starts to make you sleep better at night. You start to be able to make sense of the world and a lot of the mysteries and the strangeness. It begins to become understandable, and it begins to be part of an unfolding evolution, and things just start to feel better, start to feel like there is something, there is some divine ordinance with this, and you get closer and closer to making contact with that. And it is, there's no better thing to do. There is no other game in town for me than this.
Excellent. Well, we were part of it tonight. We made our change. We affected the universe.
Absolutely. There's no question about that. Just speaking about these things, giving people the opportunity to think, having people participate, even though they're not speaking, you know, with us directly necessarily, you know, we're not bothered about that. It's the consciousness coming together. That's what matters. So whether they see us on a stage or whether we never meet each other, the fact that we are speaking with each other consciously and people are giving their consciousness to this endeavor, and we thank them for that, that's what matters. Because every time we do this, we change, and then we go out into the world and we change the world a little bit as well.
Well, that's the whole idea. We look for the good in others and help it to come out and build a little bit every day, and before long, you'll save the planet.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for coming on the program, Neil. You're wonderful as always, and don't speak to many people who say they are a philosopher. A modern philosopher maybe is what we need in these times.
Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate it, and thank you for the work that you do and taking the time and effort to do it off largely always our own penny, really, isn't it? So, yeah.
My pleasure. All right, we're out of time, Neil, so I have to let you go. I will extend the invitation to you I was just given to appear at the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference October 10th through 12th of this year, if you're open.
Right. I'll take a look at that. That sounds fascinating.
I'll get them to pass that along to you. It'd be a great addition to the speaker group. All right. Have a wonderful week, my friend. We'll speak again soon.
All right. You take care now. Goodbye.
Good night. All right, Earth Explorers. That's it for X Squared Radio tonight. What we're going to do is play our exit right now, and we'll see you again next week. I'll be traveling, so we'll probably run an archive, but the week after that, most certainly. Thank you very much, Earth Explorers, for being part of X Squared Radio.